House Committee on Revenue for Monday, May 18th, 2009, for our marathon will come to order. Colleagues, we are not ready on House Bill 2180 or House Bill 3472. The 2180, of course, as you know, there's a transition in the executive branch that we'll have to consider. And 3472 needs some amendments before we can send it to the floor. I think Representative Kotek is here, so I want to open the bill that she is involved in, and that is House Bill 2904. Yes. So we'll open for public hearing, House Bill 2904. Day?
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. House Bill 2904 comes from Agriculture House, Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. And what it does is it expands the definition of farm use for the purpose of special assessment and property taxation to include the implementation of a plan to remediate or mitigate severe adverse conditions on a farm parcel. And it prohibits application of farm income requirements for the purpose of special assessment and property taxation during the period in which such plan is implemented, and exempts from property taxation the machinery and equipment used to implement such plan. And the bill applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2007. It takes effect on 91st day following adjournment sine die. That's the essence of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Kotek.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, colleagues. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity today to speak with you about House Bill 2904. This bill had a very supportive public hearing in the Ag Committee, and then we went into a long gap in trying to come up with amendments to this bill because after it first came out, we received some suggestions. And so we've been working. We apologize for getting it to you at such a late date, but we hope you can be supportive and move it to the floor. What we have before us, I was approached by some constituents in my district. This might seem odd, but I do have farms in my district. I represent mostly north and northeast Portland. If you're heading north on the I-5, if you look east before you cross the bridge, there's a more green open area. That's the East Columbia neighborhood in my district, and in that area of my district is Fazio Farms, which is a near century old farm that for many years raised cucumbers. And then they ran into a problem several years back where they had basically a fungus on their cucumber crop, and they had to stop farming. Now they're in a non-farming area, but they have a special property assessment to farm in that area. But state law says if your farmland lays fallow for more than a year, then it reverts back to the existing property tax status. In the Fazio Farm case, they went about trying to come up with a way to mitigate the problem on their farm to bring in debris and gravel to raise the soil level of the farm property that they had been using where the fungus problem was. And when the county came by and realized that they had not been farming, they hadn't been farming for a couple years at this point, they assessed them back property taxes. And then, so the Fazios came to me and said, "We have this particular situation." And whereas I'm not a big supporter of looking at statute just to fix one particular situation, I thought that their individual situation warranted a look at policy. Basically, if you are in, you're trying to farm and you run across a problem and you try to mitigate it by, you know, bringing in soil or other means, that you should have more than a year to remediate. And that's what this bill is about. And with me today is Carol Levine, who works with the Fazio family, and she can speak to more about their particular situation. Maybe I'll just leave it to her then.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Carol Levine. I'm a tax lawyer representing Fazio Farms, and I'm from Gladstone. I think Representative Kotek gave a pretty good background, but let me give you just a little bit more information. The Fazios basically broke new ground, literally, by developing this sort of remediation plan on their own. There was really no guidance out there. And so they took it upon themselves to consult with the OSU Extension Services to get some help coming up with the plan and implementing it and so forth. And so for various reasons, the plan took longer than they ever anticipated. And when Multnomah County noticed that they weren't farming, they removed them from the farm use special assessment. And in fairness to the county, there are, you know, farmers out there in non-EFU zones that do, if you will, kind of scam the system. And so I think when they saw that the land hadn't been in production, obviously, they did disqualify them. And after they realized that the FASIOs were, in fact, trying to farm and had been mitigating, we were able to work on a collaborative basis with Multnomah County initially to get this bill introduced with the assistance, obviously, of Representative Kotek. And then since then, we've been working with the Farm Bureau and the Department of Revenue to come up with a bill that will not only address the FASIO situation, but also assist any non-EFU farmers in the future should they come up with a situation that the FASIOs were faced with so that they can continue to farm. And just to give you some numbers, and again, I have this in the materials that I submitted today, but the impact of the disqualification for the FASIOs is substantial. For the 2 years that they were disqualified, the taxes, the real property taxes alone were $165,000 per year as opposed to $11,000 per year under farm use. And then, again, with the disqualification from farm use, the county saw the equipment and machinery that they were using to mitigate, to implement their remediation plan and assess personal property taxes on those and did the current years as well as the omitted property assessments for 5 years back. So this bill would really relieve the FASIOs of a substantial tax burden. The FASIOs have only paid the real property taxes as if it was under special assessment, so it would not cause Multnomah County to have to issue a large refund check. With respect to the personal property, the FASIOs did pay 1 year of that, which is about $17,000. The omitted property alone are $139,000. And so we're hoping that even with the $17,000 that could be used it would be refunded under this bill with no interest, and that could be used to offset some of the personal property taxes for the other years. So we would really appreciate this committee's support.
Thank you. Don, good morning.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Oregon Farm Bureau supports the bill. We have had plenty of discussions regarding when a property is in farm use and when it's not. The FASIOs provide an example of probably an infrequent but probably more common than we realize event where remediation has to occur longer than that 1 year fallow period. The key here is within the legislation there is a clawback period so that you do have to farm post remediation for a period, and those discussions are ongoing, but the amendments that were drafted, Farm Bureau has reviewed those. We've consulted with Department of Revenue. John Phillips, who staffs for the department, is on furlough today, but those conversations have occurred, and both sides are fairly comfortable with the new amendments. So with that, I'll conclude and open up to any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much.
And, Mr. Chair, do you have the dash ones, I believe?
We do.
Okay. And so the dash ones were, it's a substantial portion of the bill, but trying to clarify, put sideboards, talk about the clawback, try to, you know, that's what took so long to come up with, kind of those statewide policy portions of it. Wanted to make sure we were making good policy here and not just applying it to one single case. So that's the dash ones are the ones we would love to see amended and have the bill moved with. So be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And, sir, did you want to be heard?
I would just hear if you had any questions about. I can get pretty long-winded about this topic.
And your name is?
Excuse me, Anthony Fazio.
Ah.
Chair Barnhart, sorry about that.
You're the owner of the farm.
Yes, and my father back here with.
It's Mr. Fazio Jr. and Fazio Sr. is over there. So.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, I'm reading the dash ones here. Basically, the idea is that it's only applicable to farm that has the special assessment that applies for the special remediation to the Department of Ag. The Department of Ag then certifies it and writes rule, and under this, they would write rules of around what this special assessment remediation program would be.
That's correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger.
And it would be longer than the one-year fallow period, but it is not specified in the bill how long it could be. Is that something that Ag would write rules around, or am I missing that? I'm looking for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that is correct. There would be an option if to have the plan reviewed and amended. I mean, I suppose there could come a point where, you know, OSU Extension or the Department of Ag would say, you've reached your limit. But they would be setting that in rule, yes.
Okay. And one other question, and you may not be the ones to answer it. How many other farms, if you will, might fall under this? I mean, these farms that are in special assessment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, when we introduced this bill in the policy committee, the other committee, we since then have not heard of others. Multnomah County doesn't believe they have a similarly situated piece of property. But as Sean was saying, I don't know if he wants to comment. I mean, there could be other cases, but unknown.
You could bring that arm down. No, maybe
probably.
You can't.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Never mind.
Chair Barnhart, again for the record, Sean Cleave. Representative Berger, in conversations I've had with the Department of Revenue rather than the Department of Ag, who is somewhat cued into these property tax issues, they're assuming maybe one or two a decade statewide.
Okay. That's fine. Thank you.
Other questions? You know, it occurs to me, and you may or may not want to comment on this, it occurs to me that with the possibility of climate change in Oregon, the possibility of remediation and the need for a farm to stop growing a crop they've grown for a long time and start growing something else might actually increase. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but that's certainly something that occurs to me as a possibility. Then the other comment I would have is it would seem to me that the kind of remediation that we're talking about that's part of a plan to get the farm back into production ought to be considered farming.
Chair Barnhart, thank you for the comments. You're exactly right. That's the perception of Oregon Farm Bureau. Our objective under Oregon's land use laws is to keep as much land into production as possible. The Fazios have a unique situation because they are in an urban center where food is needed, and providing ways for regional crops and maybe, you know, distributing to local markets is probably a better model moving forward. So, thanks.
And Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the comment as well. In fact, this is, you know, part of the reason we're trying to keep this urban farm within the city of Portland limits and keeping it close to markets. And it's in a very industrial area, but we heard comments from other residents who came and testified at the other committee about how great it is to live next to a farm and have the ability to be close to a farm. And this is a unique situation, but I'd rather have that farm than another, you know, parking lot with trucks on it, which is what's more or less close to the farm now. So,
thank you. Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much.
We appreciate
your testimony and Representative Kotek, the work you've done to help bring this bill. Philip Kennedy Wong, Jed Tompkins, Randy Walruff. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Philip Kennedy Wong with Multnomah County. I want to begin by thanking Representative Kotek for presenting not only this bill, but the amendments that are really a reflection of some of the issues that we saw from the assessment standpoint that have statewide policy effects. What we want to do today in terms of our testimony is present some improvements that we believe that will ensure that there aren't any bad actors, and at the same time ensure that DeFazio's, have what it is they need out of this bill to get them to a place where they can begin farming again. Who I have here with me is County Tax Attorney Jed Tompkins, who will go over some very minor improvements that we think that can be brought to this bill, and also our County Assessor, Randy Walruff, who can answer any questions that you may have as far as the particulars of the case with Multnomah County. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jed Tompkins, who will go over some very simple changes we think that will make the bill much more stronger on a statewide perspective.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Jed Tompkins, Assistant Multnomah County Attorney. As Philip just mentioned, we're quite in favor of the underlying concept of this bill and very appreciative of the amendments we've seen so far. One of our concerns with the idea from the get-go was that there be a return to farming after the period of remediation, and that was just mentioned in the prior testimony. The idea is having some clawback to sort of act as a prompt for getting this land back into farm use after some period of remediation. Representative Kotek has added to her original bill that language, and we're very appreciative of that. That's in Section 6 of the -1 amendments. What I would just like to add is that the same language be inserted into ORS 308A703. The way the program works, there are two instances in which additional taxes may be imposed upon land. And what the -1 reflects is a remediation-oriented clawback in one of those instances. And a similar amendment to ORS 308A703 would address the other circumstance in which that could occur. And in that way, we'd have a prompt across all boards for returning this land to farm use. So that's the first improvement we'd suggest. The second improvement we'd be looking for is to just insert into the bill a little bit more clarity as to the scope. And what I'm referring to is, as it stands right now, the sort of the catch term is severe adverse conditions. And we'd just like to make sure that this is not referring to conditions that are caused intentionally or negligently through apathy or some omission of the farmer. We don't want those kind of conditions to qualify for remediation, but something more outside the control of the taxpayer. And then another suggestion, and I think maybe Representative Berger, you were touching upon this, is the term limits and frequency of remediation at this point are left to administrative rule, and we'd ask that there be some clarification on that to establish a period of time within remediation must be completed. And I think a piece of that would also be the frequency with which any particular portion of land could undergo remediation. You know, for instance, not allow that portion to go back into remediation for a period of 10 years, something along those lines. You know, it would prompt the taxpayer to address all issues up front, and also not have back-to-back remediation plans where we have a parcel of land that's essentially non-farming in perpetuity. I think some of those limits in the statute would be helpful in the creation of administrative rules. So, and the last thing that I have here under improvement number two of the written testimony is it's typical for tax exemption statutes and the special assessment statutes to include the basic administrative elements. We're talking about application deadlines, the contents of the application. In this instance, it might be appropriate to identify who the applicants might be because it may not be the owner of the land. Land in farming could be leased out and things like that. So that's the second category there. Moving on to the improvement number three of the written testimony. We're looking to maintain the intent of ORS 307-394, which is an exemption for farm machinery and equipment. The bill appropriately amends that exemption to specifically include machinery and equipment that is used in a remediation plan. But the way the statute's drafted, the equipment that receives an exemption under that statute is equipment used primarily for the certain purposes that are specified in the statute. And we would just add that the same limitation be placed on the exemption for equipment used with remediation, that it's the primary use of that equipment, not just tangential use of the equipment in remediation, say one day or something like that. And then, excuse me, I just want to turn to a particular page here. In section 3 of the dash 1 amendment, it's on page 2. We'd like the committee to consider lines 22 through 30. What's provided here let me back up. The statute that's being amended in Section 3 here is a disqualification statute. Land in the program will be disqualified if the following things happen. And what this amendment provides is, however, we will revoke the decision to disqualify if the assessor subsequently notified that the taxpayer is going to seek a remediation plan. This seems a little bit backwards in time. We would ask that these lines 22 through 30 be deleted, and rather have a taxpayer who has a right to go into remediation assert that right up front by just applying for it. It's administratively inefficient and thereby costly to have the assessor go through a disqualification process only to discover that the taxpayer qualifies for a right that they could have asserted. However, if the committee determines to keep that amendment, there are some other things the committee might consider. First, there's a reference in line 22 on page 2 to ORS 308A-706, and that is the statute that defers the imposition of additional taxes. And the confusion here may be my own, and if it is, you think it is. Okay. I'll just make my statement and maybe eat my words later. It seems that that's referring to an instance where we might defer taxes. However, if the disqualification is revoked, there's no additional taxes to impose and would be no additional taxes to defer. The other thing I note is that in order to get the disqualification reversed, the taxpayer needs to, in Section 3A, Big A, notify the assessor and then file an application. It seems that there should be a third element, that the application be subsequently approved. Otherwise, all that I have to do is file the application and the disqualification is reversed. And then lastly, I'm not sure if I'm following this correctly either, but in 3A, Big B, that's line 27 on page 2, it states that the application is to be filed, the application for certification of remediation plan is to be filed with the assessor, and I believe that they're setting up a system where that would be certified by the Director of Agriculture, which I agree is appropriate, but so it might be that we're supposed to be applying for a special assessment pursuant to remediation plan. And that's all I have, and I can take any questions.
Thank you. Waller.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I am Randy Waller from Multnomah County Assessor. We're here today, as has already been mentioned, to support this bill. I liked your comment regarding climate change and how perhaps we will see more needs for a remediation-type plan in the future. Our overriding goal in this and what Jed has just presented to you is to make sure that we have a bill that can anticipate future needs so we will not be back here in 2 years trying to clean up something due to an unintended consequence. So our primary focus right now with the legal risk of what Jed's just gone through is to make this a bill that can stand the test of time as much as you could. I've been in this business for a long time and have seen a lot of unintended consequences that come from having these gaps as we try to fix things piecemeal. So I would ask that you would consider the amendments that Jed is proposing this morning, and we're more than willing to work with whoever needs to be worked with to try to tighten this up. And as Jed mentioned, relieve the Fazios of the situation that they're in, but have an everlasting bill for as long as possible. Thank you. And I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. first, what's the other assessment that you talked about in the beginning? You said there's an other assessment, but you never told us what it was.
When I was... there are two instances where additional taxes may be imposed, and in the current program, the additional taxes are the incentive to keep land in farm use that's in the program. The idea being if that land is disqualified from the program, a certain amount of back taxes will be collected. And and there are two instances when that calculation will occur, and the first is simply when land is disqualified and it's converted to a non-farm use. Mm-hmm. The other circumstances occurs where land is disqualified, but it's not been converted at that time to a non-farm use. It just farming isn't occurring. In that situation, under the current statutes, the additional taxes are deferred. And the provision that is addressed currently in the Dash 1 amendments here is the calculation of additional taxes when, during the period of deferral, the land is then converted to non-farm use. So there's two scenarios under which additional taxes will be imposed, and so far the bill only covers one of them.
Okay. Yes, please.
And one of the issues that you talked about was back-to-back remediations within a period of time. And I personally can see instances where the remediation, no matter how well-intentioned, didn't quite get there. And a new plan would have to be filed to actually continue and complete remediation. I personally have a problem with eliminating that possibility.
And so do I. And that's not a suggestion I would advise. I would not suggest that we say remediation plans can only last X number of years. But we could say that they shall be a certain number of years unless certain criteria are triggered to qualify for an amendment of that plan, for instance. And I would think that the Department of Agriculture would be the party best able to create rules along those lines, since that would be in there.
That's all for now.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, I think that there's some difficult except for language in here, and rather than bring the drafter out to explain the complications of this, I'm very satisfied in sections 9 and 10 that our language is, if not exactly perfect, as things aren't, that we're very close to getting at allowing the Department of Agriculture, who is who I want to establish the rules here, because I'm on the Revenue Committee, not on the Ag Committee, and I don't think I can write rules around this the way they can. So I'm very satisfied that they can do the rulemaking around this, and I also put on the record earlier deliberately that there's very few who would qualify for this. I don't think that, you know, if we don't get it absolutely perfect, that the Department of Ag can't work with you to get this to be a very workable situation in the very narrow scope that we're talking about, probably one farm, maybe two. So I like this very much, Mr. Chair, and I think we can get there. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Other questions? Thank you very much. Is there someone from the Department of Agriculture who wants to be heard this morning?
Thank you very much.
All right, and Mr. Phillips from the Department of Revenue is not here for the reasons that have already been stated. Yes, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative. Thank you for letting me make a couple closing comments. I want to say thank you to the county for trying to come up with additional language. The challenge of this bill has been trying to accommodate very specific language. What do you put in rule? What do you, you know, what should be in statute? It is a very small set of circumstances that this, which is a good policy, would actually apply to. I'm just very concerned about timeline and would be very willing to consider to, if we can tweak it on the Senate side, go that route. But I'm not even sure we have a fiscal revenue impact back yet on the dash ones. But I know I'm just concerned we might lose the bill if we don't move it. So though not perfect, I think we're close, as the good representative said, and I would hope you'd be able to move it as soon as possible. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Colleagues, my intention, after what we've heard, is to close the public hearing today and set it for either, hopefully later in the week, if we can find a time to do that, to hear from Mr. Phillips and further consider the Dash 1 amendments. It is correct that we do not have the paperwork that we need today in order to work the bill. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2904. And if there are thoughts about that, please contact me about it. And, of course, I have mixed all my papers in, so I don't know what I'm doing next. You have it.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's helpful. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3199. There it is. Found it. Colleagues, we have a revenue statement. We do have a fiscal.
Mr. Chair, the members of the committee, the fiscal and revenue statements on these bills that you have today are back to back because we're trying to save on trees. So,
thank you. Discussion on 3199. I have a question, if I could, Mazin. On your proposed impact, you have a comment about the suggested debt limits. Are these updated for the results of the meeting last week, or are these from the last time they met in January, February?
Mr. Chair, I think this is the March.
The March report.
The March report. This was updated to the March forecast, but not to the May 15. I know the debt limit have gone up slightly as a result of reduction in interest rates. So that might have a little more ceiling underneath it to get some more bonds. However, I think that all of the bonding bills would have to be put together in one sort and then judged against that ceiling of bond limit.
All right. And it's my hope to get this bill to Ways and Means for the purpose of allowing Ways and Means to determine exactly how those all those bonding demands fit together. Representative Bentz?
Mr. Chair, I would be willing to make the motion that we refer this matter to Ways and Means without recommendation.
Representative Bentz moves House Bill 3199 to Ways and Means without recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection to that motion? I don't see any. Motion carried. Bill goes to Ways and Means. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3199. And we'll move on to our public hearing on Senate Bill 589.
Okay. I'll be back.
You'll be back. Oh, I'm sorry. If I'd realized that, we'd have called the one you wanted. We're playing musical committee administrator chair this morning. Hey.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, excuse me. Senate Bill 589 repeals 5-year time limit for exemption from property taxation of Indian tribal land if acquisition of the land by the United States in trust status, so-called fee to trust conversion, has been requested or is in process. It repeals sunset of such exemption for property tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2012, and it applies to property tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2008.
Thank you. Justin and Martin. Sorry, I can't read last names, so, and I'm supposed to know these, aren't I?
Justin and Martin.
It's Justin and Martin.
Justin and Martin. Oh, come on. Monday.
No, actually, I got that wrong all the way, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
You know who I meant.
Thank you, Chair Bernhardt and members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Michael Mason of the team Mason and Martin.
I should have been able to figure out that meant Michael, but I couldn't get there.
That's okay. I think Justin's taking after me in the legibility department after all these years of being an attorney. I can't read my own writing. But
I feel better.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 589. This was a bill that was very well received in the Senate and passed, as I recall, 28-1, passed the Senate. This is a bill that makes a fairly minor amendment to a bill that was passed by the Legislative Assembly in 1993. At that time, the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde and the Confederated Kuzlo, Umpqua, and Siuslaw tribes came forward, both making the effort to restore their land bases. Of course, both tribes had been terminated under the Western Oregon Termination Act in 1954, along with the other tribes in Western Oregon. The Legislative Assembly decided as a policy matter that it would help the tribes restore their land bases. The federal government certainly should be in the lead on that, but this was a way that the state could assist to whenever the tribes requested a parcel of land be put in trust by the United States to to be added back to their original land bases generally, that the state would exempt it from property tax assessment. The situation, and at that time, of course, the tribes had virtually no revenue. And that's still the case for several of the tribes. But the fact is that this has proceeded much more slowly than expected, especially in the last 8 years. We currently are facing a situation with a number of the tribes where land has been in the system for 4 or 5, even 6 years. When the legislature adopted this policy in 1993, and that was just after I had been at the Department of the Interior working on land acquisition issues, we were able to take land in trust at that time within 6 months to a year. At the outside, it took 2 to 2.5 years to take land in trust. In the last several years, largely because I think of distractions with other issues, it's now to the point of taking, as I say, 5 or 6 years. So there is significant, there's several hundred acres anyway that will suddenly be subject to the tax, property tax again. We don't think that's really what was intended by the Legislative Assembly, and certainly the tribe shouldn't be penalized for the federal government just taking its sweet time to act. Now, you'll see here on the revenue impact that there is approximately 9,400 acres in the process or in the pipeline now to be put in trust with the United States. And I guess I should mention, just for clarity, you know, everyone's heard of Indian reservations. People don't necessarily hear about what trust land is. Trust land is generally the first step, but not, it's not necessarily meaning that land will be reservation. When we talk about trust, we're referring to land that's held by the United States for the benefit of an Indian tribe, at least in the case of this legislation. And what that basically means is the United States holds the underlying title, and the tribe, the particular tribe, is the beneficial owner. The tribe has a fair bit of control of what happens on the land, but the United States acts as trustee and has to make sure that waste does not occur on the land, that fair market value is given for timber, for example, or minerals, and that the federal environmental laws are followed. So, for example, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and so forth, that kind of pantheon of environmental legislation that any of us have worked on development on federal lands or Indian lands have come to dread. At any rate, just to clarify what that is, and happy to answer questions about that, but the point on this 9,400 acres is approximately 8,000 of those acres just went into the pipeline, just were requested to be put in trust by tribes in the last year. So in terms of the next biennium, this wouldn't affect that great majority of the land that's going into trust, because there already is the 5-year tax exemption. So I just wanted to clarify that. And I'm happy to answer questions, but turn it over to
Mr. Martin.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. We are here today in full support of Senate Bill 589 and hope that you will move it on to the full Senate. We have a little under... We have just a little under 11,000 acres in Grand Ronde and just a little bit under 5,000 tribal members. Passage of this bill would give the tribe another tool to help with the fee to trust process that is consistent with our tribal goals and objectives for such projects as housing, education, health care, wellness, and public safety. With restoration and reestablishment of the reservation, these efforts have focused on rebuilding our tribal institutions. While we have had some success, Mr. Chair and members, in the last 10 years or so in terms of economic development, we're working very hard to restore and reestablish our land base and our cultural values and beliefs in and around the Grand Ronde area, which was originally a 69,000-acre reservation. These efforts have provided the tribe an opportunity to create a viable community contribute to the local economy, and also provide for the achievement of tribal self-sufficiency. We're well on our way to getting there, but again, it's very difficult to make up for 29 years of termination and a really poor history prior to that. I wanted to give you a little snapshot in the testimony that you see in front of you today. It actually lists out the properties which are in the fee to trust process. As you can see, it's not a lot of acreage, about 145 acres total. But I think what's important to point out there are three of those properties. Two of them have been in the process for over 5 years, and one of them has been in the process for over 8 years. So again, this would be a valuable tool in helping us continue down the road towards self-sufficiency and to get at some of those goals and objectives, especially bringing tribal members home and trying to create some economic diversification in and around the reservation. So with that, please support Senate Bill 589 and send it to the full House. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could one of you or both of you explain how something gets into the pipeline? What's the process of something starting to be in this trust land?
Well, Chair Barnhart and Representative Riley, for the record, again, Michael Mason. I neglected to mention I'm here representing the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs, but also I'm authorized to speak for the Confederate Tribes of the Siletz at this time because their representatives couldn't be here today. But back to that, and having worked on the acquisition of tens of thousands of acres of land in this process, the process has evolved. One of the reasons it's taking longer now is it's a much more complex process than it was in 1993. What has to happen is initially a tribe will ask the Regional Bureau of Indian Affairs office, will that office decide to take this land into trust? The tribe has to provide a business plan if economic development is considered, has to identify the uses for the property, for example, housing, a clinic, whatever the use is of that property. And then, of course, has to provide tax information, has to make sure the taxes are current. And the initial steps that the Bureau takes, Bureau of Indian Affairs takes, are a level one hazardous materials survey of the property. One of the issues about land being in trust, you're not going to take land in trust that buys you a lawsuit for the United States. The Department of Justice will not allow that to happen. So you have to look at, is this land worthwhile for the tribe to even acquire? And so that analysis starts with the hazardous materials audit, goes on with the regional director of the Bureau of Indian Affairs sending a letter to the local governments that are affected and to the governor, asking about jurisdictional impacts and tax impacts and any other impacts that would occur to the local government or the state to have the land transferred. There's, of course, a title search done and, you know, other considerations. For example, are there endangered and threatened species that would be affected by the land being taken into trust or by the any change in the use of the land? If there's a significant change in the use of the land, then you have to go through the National Environmental Policy Act process, which we commonly think of as the EAs and the EISs. That is to say, an environmental assessment has to be done, or a full-blown environmental impact statement has to be done at the expense of the tribe. So now that often doesn't happen. For example, if the land's being taken into trust for wildlife purposes or mitigation of dams or some such, then that's not a change in use, and that's considered a categorical exclusion. When the regional director gets a response from the local governments and the governor about the impacts, he or she send that to the tribe. The tribe gets a chance to respond to that. Ultimately, a decision gets made. If it's a controversial enough matter or large enough parcel or involves gaming, it gets shipped back to Washington, D.C. to be considered there. And that process is, of course, very time-consuming. But the once the issues, there's an opportunity for the tribe to discuss and try to resolve issues with the local governments or the governor. Once that's done, then the regional director makes a decision about taking the land trust. Let's say that decision is positive, which it often is. At that point, there's an appeal period for the state and the local governments if they choose to appeal that, which would go to the Interior Board of Indian Appeals. And if I'm going into too much detail, you're all wide awake still, but I'm happy to cut this off at any time. But it would go to the Interior Board of Indian Appeals in Washington, D.C. That's a process in itself. After that, there's federal court review if it goes that far.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
So that was, as you say, a very long... the only thing left that I want to know is who owned that land before this process started?
Well, when there's a request to put land in trust, the tribe has to have an interest in the land. In almost every instance, the tribe will be the full owner of the land. And the Justice Department really, really seriously disfavors, again, with the not wanting to buy a lawsuit, taking any land in trust on which there's a mortgage or someone else holds another interest that hasn't been acquired by the tribe as yet.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Great. Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much land it could be designated as trust land? As we look across our state, I'm just looking at this, the way this reads, its acquisition has been requested. So the land has been acquired by a tribe, and then inclusion as a trust parcel has been requested. So I'm just trying to get a grasp on how much land we could be or should be concerned about falling within the scope of this proposed bill.
Well, Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, there's the limitation is really on how much the tribes are capable of purchasing. Are there willing sellers, and is there going to be significant resistance from the state and the local governments? Because the state and local, let me just tell you my experience, and that is, even though this isn't stated in regulation except as to gaming land, if a governor opposes a parcel of land going into trust, and it's almost for whatever reason, it's never going into trust. And that's been the case since at least the late 1970s. So there's one, that limitation. But the primary limitation is tribes' ability to purchase. Many tribes, and you'll see Burns Paiute, for example, they don't have land in the process because they don't have the land to purchase it. There's no money available. Unlike the situation in the 90s, there's no money available for tribes to buy land from the federal government, so they have to come up with it somehow.
Yeah, Representative Vance.
Thank you for that clarification, but I need a little more detail in how many acres one might be concerned about. And the reason I ask is because I have had occasion to hear how successful some of the gaming operations have been, and I'm happy for that. But it does provide those who are involved in the gaming industry with large amounts of cash to buy land. And so that issue that you just remarked upon, the lack of money for certain tribes, is not an issue. It's really an issue of how much land could be trust land. That's my question. How much land could fall within that category of trust land?
Well, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, there's the limitation that's used by the Department of the Interior, the geographical limitation at this time. They're just not taking land into trust, and that's their policy, not to take any land in trust that's outside of the original territory of a tribe. And as far as the gaming side, there's also a commutability standard. They're refusing to take land in trust that's 100 miles away from existing reservation. So there are some limits in that sense. To focus in on the land being taken in trust at this time, you're right that two of the tribes with gaming money have begun to reacquire land, the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua and the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. The Umatilla land is strictly within their reservation boundaries, so they're not expanding out. They're consolidating because half of that reservation is owned by non-Indians. As far as the Cow Creek, they have fewer than 3,000 acres anyway, so the fact that they're able to acquire some land means that the policy is helping or working, that the Legislative Assembly has adopted to help the tribes reacquire some of their land.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not opposed to the acquisition of land by the tribe. I'm trying to get an idea of the scope. And so far I heard about limitations. I haven't heard anything about how much land would fit within the trust label or under that label. Perhaps you could share with me that again, because I didn't hear it.
Is the question posed on line 8 of the bill, which is how much land is in the ancient tribal boundaries? That's the arena, is it not?
Land is located within ancient tribal boundaries of the tribe. That would be part of the language from the original law that would remain.
Right, correct.
So perhaps is that the question that Representative Bentz is asking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, from Grand Ronde's perspective, a couple things. One, the first test is Aboriginal territory. You would look at the lands that were ceded under treaties in the 1850s. For us, that would be the first case. The second case for Grand Ronde, and in our Restoration Act of 1983, within that act, we talk about taking land into trust for reservation purposes within a three-county area. That's Polk, Yamhill, and Tillamook. And as I mentioned earlier in my testimony, it is Grand Ronde's objective to try and get as much of that original 69,000-acre reservation back into trust and or reservation status for the purpose of getting at those goals and objectives that we talked about, healthcare, housing, education, et cetera, in and around the reservation. We do acquire other properties throughout the state, and looking at other business ventures, those have been done in fee.
In fee meaning not to be included in the trust lands or in the reservation.
Correct, Mr. Chair. We are not looking at this time to bring those into trust status and or reservation status outside of that three boundary
area. And are those properties subject to property taxes?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And Chair Barnard, if I may, Chair Barnard and Representative Bentz, I may not have been apprehending the question correctly, but in terms of the historic territory of the tribes, that's all of Oregon. In terms of the nine tribes, it's all of Oregon except for the very northeastern corner, which, of course, was Nez Perce country, around Imnaha, Joseph, Enterprise, that area. A chunk of southeastern Oregon that is Paiute country, but more properly not Burns Paiute, but the Paiutes further south around Winnemucca and that area. And then the corner of southwestern Oregon, most of Coos, or I should say Southern Coos and Curry counties, which were not part of the Coquille country, they belonged with tribes further south. So there are three corners of the state that would not be affected by this. But, the tribes had everything else. So.
Yes. Final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The old bill, the old language said transfer of the land to a trust was the triggering device. Now it will be acquisition of the land. The word transfer of the land to the trust has been requested. That meant then that there had been approval and the tribe was asking for a conveyance. Is that what that meant? I'm just trying to get an idea of what the actual change is that this bill would affect.
Well, Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, the original bill was, if I may say, inartfully drafted. Transfer of land to a trust, that's not the language used in 25 Code of Federal Regulations 151, which is the regulations there are several statutes as well affecting Oregon tribes, but those are the regulations that are used by the Bureau of Indian Affairs to perform a trust acquisition. So that technical change doesn't change what the exemption applied to or how it applied. The only changes in the bill are removing the sunset and extending the five-year exemption period.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the change from transfer of the land to the trust is not a big change in your mind to the acquisition, transfer on the one hand, acquisition on the other. You're saying that they're one and the same?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, that's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have a couple. The new language, beginning on line 19 on the first page, appears to say that the sideboard on this is let me back up. If I understand the bill correctly, this takes land that's where there's been an application for the acquisition of the land by the United States in trust status off of the property tax rolls. Until subsection 2 applies, or unless, maybe is a better word, that the federal government enters a final administrative determination denying the request for acquisition. Now, is that the only sideboard, or is there something else? It seems to me there are two paths. One is you have acquired land, you've applied for trust status. Ultimately, the request is granted, and the land goes into trust and therefore follows under a different law.
That's correct.
The other possibility is the federal government says, no, we're not going to do that, and it falls out under lines 19 through 26 on page 1. Is there any other path that could happen?
Well, Chair Barnhart, this hasn't happened so far, but the tribe could withdraw the request to have the land put in trust.
All right. Would that amount?
It would not be in the process. It would not be land that is in the process or for which there's an application.
Okay. So, in other words, a withdrawal would come under lines 11 and 12. Because it would no longer be in process.
That's correct, Chair.
All right. Thank you. That's helpful. Can you tell us about instances when the federal government enters a final administrative determination denying the request for acquisition of the land in trust status in Oregon?
I'm trying to think of... Chair Barnhart, let me point out that Oregon is unique, Oregon is unique in having more tribes terminated in the 1950s during this experiment than any other state. For that reason, until recently, it's been relatively easy to put land in trust, particularly in the vicinity of the or within the boundaries of original reservations of the restored tribes. So, as far as land being turned down for acquisition in Oregon, I'm not familiar with any situations. I am familiar with situations in other states. There are quite a few requests that were denied in the last couple of years. They were mostly for gaming, some were for other purposes. There were approximately 40 applications of different tribes that were denied in the last 2 years. But what's generally happened is this kind of just dragging it out, not taking action. There are no deadlines. There are no timelines for these decisions. The only real deadlines are getting notice out to the local governments and the governor, making sure those notices go out, letters of request I mentioned earlier about jurisdictional and tax and other impacts. But after that, there are no deadlines at all. So it can just sit, and it's, to get it to move, you then have to bring a lawsuit based on arbitrary and capricious behavior under the Administrative Procedures Act, which is very difficult to establish.
So, in effect, then, these applications could be neglected in Washington or somewhere else, and the land may sit kind of in limbo.
And Chair Barnett, that's exactly what's happening.
All right. Now, what you've included here the lands that are currently in the process from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. Are there other lands that are currently in the process now as well in Oregon?
Yes, Chair, there are. The bulk of the lands, and I'm not remembering the exact breakdown, but of the 9,400 acres mentioned here, approximately 8,000 acres, approximately 8,400 acres, are owned by either the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Reservation or the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua that are very recently in the process. So you've got the lands, as I recall, the Umatilla lands are about 6,000 acres. Those are wholly within the reservation boundaries. Then you have the approximately 2,400 acres within the vicinity of the current Cow Creek Reservation, which is quite a small land area. And then there are, you've got the Grand Ronde in front of you. The Warm Springs have approximately 500 acres very near the Warm Springs Reservation that are in the process, mostly in Jefferson County. The Coosla, Umpqua, and Siuslaw have about 70 acres in the process, land that had been federal land. Coos Head is the largest parcel that the United States has just returned to the tribes. But because of an odd aspect of the law, the transfer didn't take the land directly into trust. It just gave it to the tribe in fee, so they're now potentially on the hook for taxes. I'm trying to remember, it's approximately 150 acres that the Confederated Tribes of the Salettes have in the process. Burns, Pyatt, and Klamath do not have any land in the process.
Okay. The reason I'm asking a series of these questions, I'm trying to figure out what other sideboards could be added to this bill that wouldn't do violence to the intent. I mean, you basically told us that some of these lands are past the time limit.
Yes.
Through no fault of the tribes, I suspect, but rather because the federal government is slow.
Yes, that's good.
I was thinking of another word, but I'll use the word slow. The law that we are amending here, or that this bill amends, had a time limit of 2012, beyond which the legislature would have to do something if the law were to continue. Is there any reason you can think of, other than the fact that it would be inconvenient later, why we shouldn't extend a statute of limitations, a sunset on this bill rather than simply repealing it?
Well, Chair Barnhart, the point is the tribes discussed this, and in terms of bringing this bill forward, that all of the tribes got together and with their representatives in what's called now the Tribal Tax Working Group. But the thought here was that the policy of the Legislative Assembly, and we're very proud of this policy, I should say the tribes trumpet this really at meetings throughout the country, the support for the state of Oregon in them rebuilding their land base. It is unique in the country. But that the policy, I guess our view was, why should the policy change? I mean, the tribes, it's taking, as we say, much longer to rebuild the land bases than expected. Part of that's about money. A lot of it's about the federal process length. We were hopeful that the Legislative Assembly would say, yes, this is our policy, and we don't need to set a timeline on it. The tribes have a long, long ways to go to rebuild their land bases, most of them. So,
right.
So that was the answer to that.
And then the other possible sidebar that occurred to me, and there may be others, would be some limitation around the boundaries of the original reservation that was eliminated in the 50s. I guess you used the word terminated in the 50s.
That's the term, yes.
Some reasonable distance from there. Is that a possible sideboard? Does that make any sense or not?
Again, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, as you can see from the perspective of Grand Ron, that is our goal within that 69,000-acre reservation. And in looking at each of the tribe's individual restoration acts, there are counties pointed out within that act in which we would make efforts of gaining that land back in trust or reservation status. For Grand Ron, again, that's Polk, Yamhill, and Tillamook counties. I don't know where the other tribes, what they have stated within their restoration acts, but I believe that they probably do. Our attorney here might or might not know that.
Well, Chair Barnhart, in some of the restoration acts, there are limitations. The Salettes Act is similar to Grand Ronde, and it refers to Lincoln. I don't have it right in front of me, but it's Lincoln and Polk, as I recall, is where the reservation would have to be. So there's that limit. I can only speak on this on behalf of the Warm Springs, but some of the land that they're looking at, almost all of it is within 50 miles of the reservation. There are some parcels that they've acquired to protect or to work on restoring salmon, primarily in the John Day. That's somewhat further away. But it's also within 50 miles of current trust land that the tribe has. The tribe has, because of their homeland and the where people were located, they have trust land on the edge of Hood River, on the just outside the Dalles, and up the John Day River. Not as far as John Day, but up the John Day River. So if it were within a reasonable distance of the current tribal trust land, I don't know that we'd have any problem with that, or if it would cause any impact at all. I don't think it would.
Okay, and for the material that you've given us here on the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, these properties are all within the area of the original reservation, even though some of them are not contiguous with reservation land. And what are these properties being used for now? Looks like at least one of them is a farm. Could you describe that just a little bit so we can get an example using the material you have here?
Sure, that's correct, Mr. Chair. Some of these properties all fit within, again, that goal of self-sufficiency for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. We're now in our fourth phase of housing, so some of these properties we've been able to bring on in and around the reservation have helped us get at those housing goals. Phase one was a manufactured housing park. Phase two was elder tribal housing. Phase three, we've done some low-income housing, and now we're looking to do even more housing. When I first started, when this guy hired me 13 years ago when he was Grand Ronde's tribal attorney, there was only one tribal member actually living on the reservation. As a terminated tribe, we've faced very difficult times. So I'm proud to say we've got quite a few units now. That's the type of thing that's going on within this property. The second one is our health and wellness center. Not only does it serve the tribal community, but it also houses the physicians from Sheridan and Willamina, the nearby towns. We employ a lot of folks on our government campus. We've got an education facility, again, housing. We've got water resources, et cetera, et cetera. And, Mr. Chair, as we continue to look to diversify our economy and try to bring other business opportunities to the reservation, these parcels of land are critically important to those goals and objectives. Again, all within the original Grand Ronde Reservation and lands that are able to do good things in putting people to work and helping build tribal programs.
Great. Does that spark? Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, I've been fighting about tax credits and tax exemptions and tax deferrals for as long as I've been here. Mm-hmm. And I've looked at this one very carefully, and I believe this is a different animal, and it's one that we should be passing out of this house.
Thank you. Other questions, comments for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on Senate Bill 589? I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 589.
I think that's a different thing.
And open a work session on Senate Bill 589. And is there a discussion at a work session? I think Representative Riley stated his opinion.
Yeah.
Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 589A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 589 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? No discussion. Is there objection? All right, bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Motion carries. Representative Riley, would you like to carry this bill?
Thank you.
Representative Riley will carry. Thank you very much. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 589 and open a work session on Senate Bill 610.
Not a public hearing?
I'm sorry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 610 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 610. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gelser.
I do that every day in my committee.
One of us is awake.
Looking for it. Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 610A deals with transportation costs that can be included in the school formula for a transportation grant. What the bill does is to expand what can be included a little bit. It includes costs that are used to retrofit or replace buses to eliminate diesel engine emissions. If those dollars are federal dollars through the Clean Diesel Engine Fund. Currently, there's both state and federal dollars that go into that fund. Neither is eligible as approved transportation grant costs for the transportation grant in the formula. This would take the federal dollars that go into the Clean Diesel Engine Fund and make those eligible for the 70% or higher transportation grant through the formula.
Thank you. We have two who would like to be heard today, Steve Hewitt and Tricia Smith.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I am pleased to be here in support of Senate Bill 610. I appreciate very much your committee hearing this bill for us this morning. Senate Bill 610 is a correction from a bill that we passed in 2007 called the Clean Diesel Act. That was House Bill 2172, and that bill allocated some funding and set up a process where diesel engines, including those that are in school buses, could be funded for retrofits that would eliminate the carbon particulates that are currently flooding into the cabins of school buses and out the tailpipes as well. If a school bus, and I'm going to talk about school buses, this applies to other diesel engines as well, but school buses are the ones we care about here. If a school bus is built after 1993, it can be retrofitted with parts that take that carbon particulate out of the air, the ambient air that comes into the cabin of a school bus. Without that, there is actually more pollution inside a school bus than there is if you were standing directly outside of it near the tailpipe. So our kids and our school drivers are currently being poisoned unnecessarily. And the longer you spend on a school bus, the more of this bad air that you breathe. Asthma is a serious health consideration for children, and it is a serious cause of absenteeism in schools. We have studies from other states that have done this on all their, Washington, for example, has cleaned up all their school buses, and they've seen a dramatic increase in, or decrease, I should say, in the number of absences due to asthma and other respiratory ailments in their children. For our school bus drivers, of course, if you spend your life in a school bus, all of your career in a school bus, you are very susceptible to lung problems, and this will help our drivers as well. Senate Bill 610 is a correction to our attempt in House Bill 2172 in 2007 to allow school districts to be reimbursed through our state transportation grant for costs of retrofitting that are first paid for by federal grants or other grants that are not state funds. When we wrote it in 2172, it wasn't written properly, so we weren't able to maximize the dollars that are available for these retrofits. The point of doing this is will allow school districts to not take scarce operating dollars to clean up their school buses, which they are very loath to do right now, and still allow them to use dollars that are available for this process. And so it will allow more school buses to be retrofitted than would otherwise happen without it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stephen Hewlett. I'm the Director of Pupil Transportation and Fingerprinting of the Department of Education. We have looked at this bill. I know when the first House bill came through, we had some problems trying to get it to work for reimbursement, and this does clarify that language. It also gives us a look on how we can track those monies so that districts, when they do get these federal grant dollars, we can make sure that's going back into the system and being reused for either retrofitting or replacing of school buses. So we do support this bill, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bruin.
Thank you. I have two questions.
Please.
First, what is the average cost of a bus retrofit? And then the second question is, I'm surprised, you say the state of Washington has done this to their entire bus fleet. How do they do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, the answer to the first question is somewhere between $7,000 and $12,000. It depends upon the bus.
Okay.
The answer to the second question is I don't know. I can get that information to you, however.
Okay. Thanks.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. For the same reason that I want to stop smoking in cars with kids, I want this bill to pass.
You want them to stop smoking diesel.
That's right.
Right. All right. This bill would cover not only retrofit, but also replacement in those circumstances in which the retrofit isn't going to work.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In buses that were manufactured prior to 1993, they cannot be retrofitted because of the way the engines were made at that time, and they must be replaced. However, I will tell you that that will occur in my dreams, at least for the foreseeable future, given the lack of funding for such things.
All right. Then a question for Steve. We have gone through the school funding issues very rapidly this session. I don't think we spent very much time on it because we didn't expect many of these bills to come up. Would you describe, and my impression of this is that this will make a very small change in effect in the way we manage the formula for transportation because we're adding to the local match. Could you describe how that transportation fund works? And how this will impact that?
Mr. Chair, the impact really depends upon how many federal dollars end up into the clean diesel engine fund. And we don't know what that amount may be. That will probably be some stimulus dollars that go there. Those dollars then, as they are used to retrofit or purchase new buses, will then be eligible transportation costs in the formula. What that is doing then is to increase the eligible transportation costs, of which then 70% or 80 or 90%, depending on the district, will be included as a transportation grant within the formula. As that transportation grant increases, it takes money away from the general purpose grant, assuming that the total available is fixed. And so then that impacts all districts somewhat through a small decrease in their general purpose grant.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add to
please.
That, please. The first round of clean diesel stimulus money has come through to DEQ, and they have determined to allocate it to cities for their diesel fleets and transit districts for their diesel fleets because they could move the money out more quickly than they could with school buses. We hope there will be additional federal money into the program. The Congress seems at this point to be committed to this program, and we expect more money in the future. But I do not anticipate a significant increase in monies available to school districts in the near term. The purpose of Senate Bill 610 is to set up our process so that when and if those fundings come available, we can use them most expeditiously and most effectively.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I missed it in your testimony, but you were talking about buses. They can be retrofitted back to 93. But at what point did this problem, or has this problem, been rectified at the manufacturers? I mean, are we talking every bus back to 93 or a segment of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, thank you for that question. In 2007, buses manufactured in 2007 and newer have all under federal law been required to clean up the diesel particulates at the engine. So it's from as long as a bus is on the road, as old as it may be, up until 2007, those buses were spewing diesel particulate matter into the cabins and out into the air.
And Chair Barnhart, I might be able to add just a little more to that, but Chair Barnhart and Representative Springer, There's been different sets of EPA requirements for diesel emissions, and in 1994 was one of the ones major. We call it this graph, and where we're going is what we call the postage stamp. Right now, the graph, you look at the CHs and the HCs. In 1994, they dropped that down to a certain point, hydrocarbons and carbon oxides. Then in 2007, they required a huge reduction down, and that's what we're at now. 2010 is even going to be a further reduction down to a postage stamp, we call it, on what compared we used to be at. There's been some, actually, what the emissions are coming out of a 2007 bus now. In L.A. County, the air coming out of the tailpipe is actually cleaner than it's going into the engine. And that has been documented. The air outside is actually got more particulates in it than is actually coming out of the tailpipe. And so by doing this, we're updating all those older buses to meet the 2007 standard, which is actually, you know, making very, very clean diesel engines.
And there are something over 3,000 diesel buses in the fleet that have not yet been retrofitted. Is that correct?
Yeah, between 1994 and 2006, we have about 3,500 school buses in that era that could be retrofitted, you know, to help emissions.
Thank you.
Are we retrofitting now to the 2010 standard or the 2007 standard?
2007.
Do we know what the 2010 standard is?
Yes.
Yes, we do. Newer engines that meet 2010 standards are going to require, in most instances, that there be another chemical that is injected into the system. It's called urea. They've been using this in Europe for many years, and it is exactly what it is. Urea, like a fertilizer, it's a liquid. And the process, the chemical reaction, actually is helping to eliminate even more emissions by that burning in with the exhaust system. But that's what it's going to require. As far as retrofitting older buses up to that point, I haven't seen that. We're mostly concerned to just getting to meet 2007 standards, which has the closed crank ventilation system and also the particulate traps in the exhaust systems.
And will this require additional maintenance beyond what the buses currently require after the retrofit?
Chair Barnhart, yes, there is some ignition as far as the particulate traps because they have to be cleaned every so often because they do collect this particle, and there's a process. There's a chamber in there that can be taken out of the muffler, and then they can either send it in and have it cleaned, or if they have purchased one of their own cleaning stations, they can actually put this in and it scrubs it clean and then reuse it. But there are plenty of companies now that are actually doing like a replacement. You know, there's enough of them out there now that if you send your dirty one in, you get another one in and you just can put it back in.
Thank you, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the retrofitting of the Oregon fleet of school buses standard by district, or are there certain districts that have fallen behind, or are there some that are way, way, way behind, or are we all about the same?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, you know, districts aren't required to do any of this retrofitting. You know, it's upon a volunteer basis. There are some large districts that have jumped on board here a few years back. While one of them was Beaverton. They have started doing a lot of retrofitting earlier, and a lot of it was trying to get grant money so that they could afford to do it because they didn't want to, you know, they just didn't have the dollars in their transportation fund to go ahead and do these upgrades, you know, at $8,000 to $10,000. There are some other ones out east that have gotten some grant money that did just the crankcase ventilation closed system retrofit. There's actually two types of retrofit. There's the crankcase ventilation, and then there's the exhaust particulate trap. A lot of them are just going with the crankcase because it's a little less expensive, and it does a lot of good because it gets rid of that dumping that out, that we call it that wastegate down below, that's just the exhaust fumes. It's reburning that and sending it out the exhaust pipe.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand if one large school district decides to take advantage of this legislation, is this going to have a perceptible impact upon others?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, if I can answer that or give an attempt to answer that. One of the things that DEQ staff have done in implementing the Clean Diesel Act is a lot of outreach to school districts, particularly small school districts and rural school districts, and facilitated bringing several school districts together. Part of the issue is you have to compete for this federal money. And the smaller the district, the less voice you know you have in that competition. So DEQ has facilitated bringing small districts together in one clump and applying for the grant collectively, and then provided that money to those smaller districts through that process. We have far more school buses and far more districts than we have money. And so we hope that the money will continue to flow into the future, and in that case, DEQ is working closely with the department and with us to encourage those districts to get their buses retrofitted.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I wasn't so much concerned about the federal grants as I was the absence of them. So we have no federal money. Is it your thought that we're not going to see any of these retrofits occur, and thus there won't be any impact? Thus, I'm just trying to get an understanding of the impact on the non-federal money that's being spent on our schools, by our schools, on this type of activity.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I can't tell you which districts have done this without the grant money, but I will tell you that in these days of very scarce resources, they're looking everywhere to save money, not expend money. So I doubt that they will be spending a lot of money on this program, as worthwhile as it is, when they're trying to figure out how to get the bus stops covered.
Thank you. That was my question.
Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, you know, if districts were to do this on their own without other grant monies, you know, they would still be eligible for that same 70% reimbursement rate as they would for anything else that goes towards transportation. There are a couple of grant applications in right now. They were due in April 28th, and those districts that were conglomerated with the county that bundled together hopefully are going to hear something by May 31st of whether they got into this series of grant monies. They're saying there may be more coming down the road in the next, you know, 3 or 4 years each year, but there is some that have put together a couple, you know, because there was like $2 million, $3 million grant. Whether they'll get any part of it or any of those three different ones, we won't know until probably May 31st. But there is a chance that some districts may have gotten some parts of those grant monies that were available in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does this clean diesel technology interact with biodiesel?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bailey, as far as I understand, it hurt to have this, you know, it actually helps some more. I've seen some different reports. There was one area up in the Columbia Basin that they were doing some samples of different percentages of biodiesel along with that in comparison, whether it had the particulate traps or not. It doesn't seem to have much of an effect other than it's less fossil fuel, so it is much cleaner. One of the problems with the biodiesel is it did raise the NOx, the NOx, up a little bit, where the particulate traps helps to take some of that out. And it also helped when they went to the ultra-low sulfur diesel. So that has been a plus on that also.
You indicate that the federal grants require a match. What sort of match do they require?
No, I don't think that there's a requirement.
Have I got that wrong? Okay.
No, yeah. I don't think there was a requirement of match on that.
So the federal grant actually pays the entire cost of the retrofit if it's granted?
For a certain number of buses. And Senate Bill 610 then would allow that district to submit those costs as reimbursable expenses, be reimbursed by the transportation grant, so long as they use that reimbursement to fund further retrofits.
Ah.
So that the bill allows them to maximize those grant dollars in terms of the number of buses they can retrofit with it. And that is in section that is in section 1 sub 3B.
Yeah, lines 25 through 27.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Okay. I see it now. Thank you. Other questions? Comments? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 610? Don't see anyone. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 610. Colleagues, any reason we shouldn't work this bill today? All right, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 610. We finally do get to the work session. Discussion? Comments? Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 610 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 610 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Yes, Representative Gelser.
I'm just glad we're moving this. It's an important bill, and we shouldn't be poisoning our kids.
I was astounded to learn that this actually makes a difference in Washington in days missed for asthma. That is an astounding fact, and I think extremely important as we look at this. Other comments? Discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? The motion is that the bill go to the floor with a due pass. Okay, no objection. The motion carries. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Those on the Transportation Committee, who do you think ought to carry this bill? Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, unless there are strong feelings otherwise, I'm happy to carry the bill.
I think you've got it. Representative Bailey will carry it. I didn't know if there was a champion in that committee who we might want to ask, but I'm perfectly happy to have you carry it. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 610 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 36. Ah, Mazin.
Mr. Chair, good morning again.
We have a bunch.
36.
Senate Bill 36. Would have been great furlough this weekend, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 36 comes to you through a process from two committees in the Senate side, Transportation Committee and Revenue Committee. And for the Senate amended the bill and became an A. So 36A basically is an enabling legislation. It allows for Multnomah County to impose tolls on bridges under its jurisdictions if it needs to. And it specifies those to be over the Willamette River. The work process or the work with the fiscal and the revenue statements on this bill, Mr. Chair, would be primarily to discuss the issues around the enabling and what would that or might that look like if it is exercised by the county. But other than that, there is no direct fiscal or revenue impact to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy Wong. Mr. Charles. Let's hear from the county first.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee for record, Philip Kennedy Wong with Multnomah County. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 36A. Let me just start by giving you sort of a sense of the origins of this bill and how it got to your committee. In the 2007 session, there was a Senate bill, I believe it was 1022, that attempted to give the authority to counties the ability to toll bridges. And the bill passed, the legislature became law, but unfortunately there was some differences of legal opinion between our county attorney and the ODOT attorney in terms of whether or not if the law that was passed in 2007 was sufficient in terms of clarifying that authority. So Senate Bill 36 was was introduced for this session in order to clarify that authority. Apparently, according to our attorney, there was some parts of Oregon statute that Senate Bill 1022 did not address. So what you have before you is actually a bill that clarifies that language. Now, with that said, just a few brief facts that you should be aware of before you consider this bill. Probably the most important fact that some of you may be asking is, does Multnomah County have any intentions, at least in the near future, of imposing tolls on the five bridges within its jurisdiction? And the answer to that question is no. This essentially would just give the county an option in terms of within its toolbox to help maintain the operations of the five bridges that's along the Willamette River, not including the Selby's Island Bridge, which is also under Multnomah County's jurisdiction. As you know, there's a lot of discussion around the transportation package in terms of what resources that may provide, but this isn't part of that that conversation, and this essentially remains a future possibility for the Board of County Commissioners to make, and it would only do so in full consultation with the state, obviously, stakeholders such as different business interests and other organizations that would be affected by any type of bridge tolling. Secondly, I just want to give you a few brief facts about the way bridges are overseen by Multnomah County. To my understanding, Multnomah County is one of the few counties in this state to have the sole responsibility as far as the maintenance and the operations of the six bridges, five obviously within Multnomah County, of which this Senate bill only addresses, is something that is a unique sort of responsibility given that our county's primary functions is centered around public safety, such as our jails, and also human services, which ranges from mental health services to aging and disability. So this, the cost of maintaining these bridges is obviously something that is of great concern for the county, and essentially this bill would give an option, a future option, for this county and for the metropolitan region to consider. So with that, that sort of concludes my testimony. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have. And just for a quick note, this bill did pass out of the House Transportation Committee, of which several of this committee members are a member of.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Kennedy Wong?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Philip, I just have a couple brief points. What right now is the current unfunded liability on the bridges that are going across the Willamette that Multnomah County is supposed to be paying to maintain or replace? And with regards to the Selwood Bridge,
Chair Barnhart and Representative Call, I believe that figure is roughly $6 million annually, but don't quote me on that. What I can do is confirm that number and let you know what the annual liability is. With respect to the Selwood Bridge, as some of you may be aware of, the bridge is in a state of disrepair, and it's, you know, rates very low on the federal safety scale of, I think, 2 out of a score of 100. I know it's... could be better. We have.
It's hard to, with the understatement
yeah.
of the day. Yes.
It's hard to be worse.
Yeah.
One presumes one is worse.
The bridge itself is under study. It's under the federal environmental assessment process right now. We do have what's called a locally preferred alternative. And we're also simultaneously in the process of developing the finance plan for the Selwood Bridge, which is required in order to get a federal match. We haven't firmed up that financing plan, obviously, because part of it is tied to a bill that you'll be hearing tomorrow, House Bill 2001. But I can give you a sense what we're looking at. To fully replace the Selwood Bridge, it would cost Multnomah County approximately $320 million in terms of you know, the overall structural cost, but also the cost of acquiring properties and all the other things that go along within the construction process. So it's not a cheap endeavor at all.
Thank you. Could you describe which bridges we're talking about? It's probably in your testimony, and I just haven't gotten to it.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, so these would be Senate Bill 36 would authorize Multnomah County to toll five bridges within the Portland jurisdiction. I'm sorry, Portland boundaries, and those five bridges are the Selwood Bridge, as I mentioned, the Hawthorne Bridge, the Morrison Bridge, Burnside Bridge, and the Broadway Bridge.
And those are all within the county jurisdiction and responsibility.
Correct. And just to clarify, we don't have authority over the Fremont Bridge or obviously the I-205 bridge or any of the other bridges, you know, which you may wonder about, or the St. John's Bridge. Just those five bridges and then plus the Savis Island Bridge, which is outside of the Portland boundary.
And would that bridge fall in under this statute? This bill?
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, currently Multnomah County already has the authority to toll the Savis Island Bridge.
Okay.
So Senate Bill 36 would only clarify statutory language to address the five bridges.
All right. And for those of us who aren't in the city and don't pay as much attention to the local issues, is one of the possibilities here that you might decide to toll bridges in order to come up with the funds necessary to rebuild the Selwood Bridge? Or is that getting too close?
Chair Barnhart,
ask the question.
We haven't looked into tolling, at least not on a significant study level, to incorporate it as part of the finance plan for the Selwood Bridge, because it's a large undertaking when you talk about tolling bridges, because there's a lot of effects, meaning that you'll have, you know, cars avoiding you know, the Selwood Bridge if the Selwood Bridge is tolled, you know, if we were to just toll that to fund it. You know, for clarification, this bill doesn't specify that Multnomah County is the only authority. It just gives them that authority. So there are some future conversations to be had as to who the best entity would be in terms of tolling these five bridges. So it could be City of Portland, it could be Metro, it could be a Port of Portland. There are a number of other entities out there that may be better suited. But this just clarifies the option for Multnomah County to be one of those candidates.
Thank you. Other questions for him? Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. And it's a pleasure to appear before you actually in favor of a bill.
Well, I was startled about that.
It doesn't happen all that often. And oddly enough, probably quite a few people who support my organization wish I wouldn't support this bill because they think tolling is a form of taxation. And if I thought that, I probably would oppose the bill. But tolls are targeted road user fees, or in this case, bridge user fees. And I'm a big supporter of user fees and have been for a long time. And I think that from a public finance and infrastructure finance standpoint, if we were to move away from general taxation and move more towards specific user fees, we would be a lot better off. We would get the adequate revenues needed to build, operate, and expand infrastructure services across the board when we need them, and the people who use them would get a much better experience from them. It's actually disappointing to me that the county is so reluctant to move forward, and they're telling you that you know, they don't really anticipate doing this. They'd like to have the authority. That's the common reaction among public officials, certainly in this state, although in many other states, road user fees are being pursued aggressively, including variations on the theme that are also very progressive, such as variable pricing on those facilities. And I think what's happened with the Selwood Bridge is a disgrace, and it's pretty clear that people are just hoping that some Minnesota-style disaster doesn't occur. I guess if it does, then we would suddenly be compelled to rush and do something. And I think the far more responsible thing would be to, in fact, aggressively move towards tolling either the Sellwood in isolation or an idea that the county, Mr. Wheeler, the county has proposed elsewhere, a Multnomah County sort of tolling authority, toll them all in an integrated fashion. I think we should be doing that. I think motorists have a high willingness to pay for facilities that they use. Unfortunately, under our current system, you don't get a chance to vote with your dollars for the facility you want. We have backdoor taxation. These facilities are perceived by the user at the point of use to be, quote, free. And I guess many policymakers like to maintain the appearance that these are free, but as I tell my own donors many times, there are no free roads. There are no free bridges. There are no free libraries. Someone is paying. And if the user is paid, and if they paid in a very specified way at the time of use, you could do a lot of good. Now, again, because tolling is not common in this state, you might wonder if we're talking about something along the lines of what Sam Barlow used when he had the Barlow Toll Road, or the first owners of the builders of the first Morrison Bridge 150 years ago, which was privately built and privately operated as a toll facility. No, we're not talking about toll gates anymore. I'm pretty confident that sometime within the next decade, the last toll gate in America will be carted off to a toll gate museum somewhere, and people who are 5 years old now will have no idea what you're talking about when you're on a turnpike and you talk about a toll gate. The technology for at least the last 20 years has been to use transponders and automatic vehicle identification, a little transponder in your windshield, and the majority of tolls now in this country are collected via ABI. Some people in Oregon have been a little distracted by the Oregon Congestion Pricing Pilot Project, which was based on GPS devices. I would just put that aside for a minute and say that that's not what one would do, or at least not what I would expect on a bridge facility. I would expect a transponder-based system, which you don't actually stop. You have a private account. You pay. And not only is this becoming commonplace, I was surprised that when I was in Florida recently visiting my parents, I could find in a public supermarket that you could buy these sun passes. This is what's used on the Florida toll roads. And it's as easy as to buy as a prepaid account for Nordstrom's or some of the gift card. There were dozens of them around. And I decided to take this. This was $5, and I wasn't going to use it because I was only going to use it for this purpose as a prop. So while I was reading the fine print trying to decide if I was going to buy this, these within the space of a minute, two different kids behind the counter, who probably were no more than 20 years old, asked me if I was going to buy this. And I said, well, I'm thinking about it. And he said, those things are great. You know, you get them, put them on your car, you make one phone call, you're good to go, you get on those toll roads. And I'm thinking, you know, there's a certain age issue here that I think people of a certain generation are not intimidated by this. And for some people, I've had this discussion for decades now about the Big Brother issue and privacy and et cetera, et cetera. Really, for a lot of folks, they understand that you put one of these on, and it's no more difficult to get than a snowpark permit if you're going to go up in the mountains. And in return, you get a facility that gives you what you want. And I think, especially in Multnomah County, the Sellwood Bridge, we'd all like to have a bridge that we don't think is going to collapse. We'd like to be able to run transit buses over the bridge again, heavy trucks over it again. And the people who are on that bridge, I think, would be happy to pay if what they got in return was a good bridge. My one caveat, I should say this since this is being recorded and being sent over the Internet, is toll revenues are subject, I believe, to the constitutional restriction on how they're spent. That is, they're to be spent on roads, bridges, and highways. And while you certainly could redesign a bridge or maintain a bridge to be accessible for heavy trucks and all forms of rubber-tire road-based transit, I don't see this as an ATM for rail programs. If the rail advocates want a new rail system in the city, they need to find their own money. Motorists are not going to be paying for that, but motorists do have a willingness to pay for safe bridges, and I hope you give Multnomah County this authority, and then I'll take up my case with Multnomah County later as to why they should be perhaps a little more enthused. Thank you.
Uh-huh. So we could have the Stumptown Pass.
Great idea.
Good idea.
That is true.
We could call it a sun pass?
We could call it a sun pass. It would be a probably
pass.
Yes.
Cloud pass, maybe?
Cloud pass. Questions for Mr. Charles? Yes, Representative Burke.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I appreciate your testimony, and I agree wholeheartedly. My question to you is, and I don't want to, if you are going to do this, we won't talk about it more today, but are you going to testify on House Bill 2001, which I think we're hearing tomorrow, and or not? Because if not, I want to ask you a little bit about some broader transportation funding.
Mr. Chairman,
it's a good thing we still have 2 hours and only one more bill.
Yeah.
Senator Bruin, yeah, I'm not sure yet. Oddly enough, you know, there's another tolling.
Well, I'd like to invite you to testify on House Bill 2001.
There's another tolling bill up today at 1, I think, in House Transportation. I'm going to testify twice in the same day on tolling issues. That's never happened. I haven't thought far enough ahead yet. At about 8 a.m., I have to go to Ben tomorrow at some point, but if you want to ask me a question now, I'm happy to answer it.
So. Well, I don't want to belabor the committee's time. It was just, you know, the same sort of philosophy and reasoning that you had for tolling for bridges, and it's, you know, if you use them, you pay for them, which is sort of the, you know, drilling down what you're getting at. How does that apply to some of the things that I know we're going to be discussing, you know, tomorrow and in the future on the transportation package, which are, you know, increased vehicle license fees, increased gas taxes, those sorts of things? And once again, the chair will get angry with me. I'm not trying to take a bunch of time on a bill we're not even hearing today, but it was just I'll leave it to your discretion, Mr. Chair.
I think you can go ahead and answer the question. If it gets too long, we'll cut you off.
All right.
Because it is related, of course, to the issue of tolling.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin. This bill is a subset of the broader question. I have long supported road user fees, marginal cost pricing, variable pricing, certainly for all highways in the state. And I have said to a number of people in this session that to the extent you can move away from fixed fees, like I think you should actually reduce vehicle registration fees and other fixed fees that have little to do with your actual use. They have nothing to do with your actual use in a certain place at a certain time in a certain direction on a certain day, all of which is germane to congestion and traffic. That I believe you would curry favor with voters if you were to look for ways to reduce fixed costs and look for ways to increase or allow increases in variable pricing, because that's how you generate the revenue you need, and it's how you reduce congestion, and that's ultimately what people want, is functioning roads that they can get around reliably. And the experience worldwide on this is that you generate a lot of cash and those facilities get upgraded and consumers are really happy. And that would be my message in the broader sense. I don't think that's necessarily the case with local roads and arterials. That's a different story. But I think for the state highway system, which is only 13% of the roads in the state but carries almost 70% of the traffic, I think that's a very high leverage strategy.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard today on Senate Bill 36? With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 36. Colleagues, are you ready to work this one? All right. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 36. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 36 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 36 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Okay. Well, with that, the Senate Bill 36 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Transportation Committee members, who should carry this bill?
I'll do it.
Representative Call. Representative Call will carry. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 36. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 34. And Mazin, you're on that one too.
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 34. Mr. Chair has to. Comes also to you from the Senate side, and it also passed through the Senate Revenue Committee as well. And Senate Bill 34 does it allows for the transit districts, primarily the two that have this authority today, which is TriMet and Lane Transit District, to increase the amounts to from 7/10 to 8/10.
tenths of 1% of payroll or wages paid. So this is a payroll tax for transit. And however, it requires that this increase in the payroll tax is phased over 10-year period, 10-year span of time. For each one of those 10 years, no more than 0.02% is to be the increment that will go in the increase. In the this language was in the law previously, is the phase out of the increase. So this is not necessarily new, but the increase in the tax from the 7/10 to the 8/10 is the new language in the bill. And Mr. Chair, with the revenue impact statement that is in front of you, this is the same revenue impact that we discussed in the Senate revenue. However, the revised version that would say at the time when we reach that full implementation, when you have that complete phase in type of work have done and you have a full rate for the payroll tax and the self-employment tax in place, and providing that these transit districts do adopt this, you would be looking at an increase of about $45 to $50 million at that time. So that's the revenue impact in front of you, and I think I also included the fiscal impact statement on this. If there was no fiscal impact statement,
there's no fiscal impact.
Right.
We have word from the LFO to that effect.
Yes, we do.
We do.
Because we passed it through the Senate.
Right, and this bill hasn't changed.
And this bill has not changed from the time that it went through Senate Transportation and Senate.
All right. Cabinet. Well, let's hear first from the transit districts. Fred Hansen, Mike Eister. August? Yes. Okay, good. Gentlemen.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Fred Hansen. I'm a general manager of TriMet, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to be able to appear before you on Senate Bill 34. Senate Bill 34 is a part of the balanced transportation package, a part of which was referenced that you'll be hearing tomorrow in House Bill 2001. Specifically, Senate Bill 34 authorizes TriMet and the Lane Transit District to seek a future, and let me stress future, increase in the employer-paid payroll tax under certain conditions. TriMet has seen unprecedented ridership increases. Well, we already have the seventh highest on a per capita basis ridership in the United States, and that's against cities such as New York City, which is in number one place, Chicago, Boston, Washington, D.C. You recognize that that the ridership, to be able to have that kind of per capita ridership in a relatively newer, middle-sized city, western city at that, is really remarkable. During the last summer, when the gasoline prices were at $4 plus, we saw our ridership increases in double digits, 13%. Generally speaking, we're seeing ridership increases at about 3 to 4% per year, but with those high prices, it was obviously a reason for a lot of people to be able to take it. I think we hear the same thing from Lane Transit District as well. For committee members that are maybe a little less familiar with transit operations, it's important to be able to think across the nation. Most transit systems are funded by sales tax. Obviously, in those states that have sales tax, all but four, However, that's not the case here. When private company, Rose City Transit in Portland, was going bankrupt in the late 60s, business leaders, the city of Portland, others came to the legislature seeking authorization to be able to create TriMet and also to establish the funding mechanism. And with the broad-based support, they chose the use of a payroll tax as a primary source of revenue. It was set in 1969 at 0.6%, and it remained that way until the 2003 legislative session. It's really the partnership with the business community that's been key in our ability to be able to continue to see transportation and transit options grow. The mechanics of it is that the payroll tax represents for TriMet just under 55% of our operating budget. As I said, the 2003 legislative session changed that for the first time from that 0.6% to 0.7%, but as in this bill as well, to be able to be phased in over a 10-year period. However, one of the specific requirements of the statute is that before TriMet or Lane Transit District are able to, in fact, increase that, they must make a finding that the economy has recovered to an extent sufficient to be able to justify that that imposition. We at TriMet ended up employing three different economists in the after the 2003 session. It's the same type of approach we would take if so authorized here. But three economists, John Mitchell, formerly of U.S. Bank, Randy Podzina from Eco Northwest, and Joe Courtwright from Impressa. All three economists evaluated the state of the economy in the greater Portland region and was based on that to be able to move forward with the implementation. What's so key about this payroll tax is that we need to be able to compete effectively at the federal government level to be able to receive discretionary grant funds. There is a what we refer to as a three-legged stool. You have to have really good projects, one leg. We have always been able to have that in the greater Portland region as well as certainly within Lane Transit District as well. The second leg of that stool is that you must have the local match to be able to build the project. That we've been able to do, and we will continue to work very hard on that. The third leg is what this payroll tax is able to do, and that is that you have to be able to show the Federal Transit Administration that you have 20 years' worth of operating revenue to ensure that there isn't something built that just then isn't utilized, a very reasonable requirement. The payroll tax allows us to do that. The increase that was in 2003 allowed us to be able to seek and receive funding for the current line that's under construction, what we call the Green Line, that will be opening September 12th of this year, extending light rail from Clackamastown Center up to Gateway and along the Transit Mall in the Central Business District of Portland. To be able to do additional projects, we need to be able to have that third leg of the stool. That's what this legislation does. I've attached to my testimony two things that I think are important. One is just a fact sheet. Hopefully that is self-explanatory. But also, we have worked very closely with our business community, and they have lent us, in many cases, a logos representing their support for Senate Bill 34. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Mike.
Chair Barnhart and committee members, my name is Mike Eister. I am the president of the Lane Transit District Board. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 34. Transit is becoming a very attractive option in our area. Our ridership has increased 35% just in the last 3 years, and our MX project is extremely successful. LTD is a national leader in transit for communities of our size. We want to be able to meet demand while it's high, but continuing budget problems have meant that LTD was forced to consider a 14.5% service reduction for this coming fall. Fortunately, we were able to avoid that and limit the reduction to only 3%, but that is a short-term fix that we were able to implement due to stimulus funding, one-time funding. Senate Bill 34 gives LTD the opportunity to address the long-term budget issues. Our board clearly understands that we must weigh local economic conditions and have a high level of communication with affected taxpayers and the public before considering local implementation of the stair-step increase this bill would authorize. Both Eugene and Springfield Chambers are neutral on this measure, and we've pledged to work closely with the chambers and the business community in considering any implementation. Thank you for your time, and I'm prepared to answer questions.
Questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Yes. Gentlemen, are your boards elected or appointed?
Appointed.
They're appointed by the governor with the confirmation of the Senate.
And so your appointed board has the authority to levy this tax, and under this they could raise the tax. Is that my understanding?
Yes, as provided for within the statute that is phased in, but only after the finding that I'd referenced earlier.
Yes, Representative Broom.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Fred, you mentioned that TriMet is the seventh highest per capita. Can you give me a scale of where TriMet is on fares paid by the riders compared to other major cities? Or maybe we're ranked. I don't know if they rank it that way.
Representative Byrne, the answer is yes. We rank just about in the middle. I could give you the whole array. Our what we call fare box recovery rate is about 22% right now. That's about average. Our fares tend to be a bit higher than average, but we tend to run longer spans of service. Consequently, the fare box recovery rate tends to be right around that middle point.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Just going back even to the last bill that we had, is sort of the concept of if you use it, you pay for it. How much analysis went into? I mean, clearly the needs are real. It's not to look negatively at that. But how much analysis prior to this proposal went into trying to recover a little bit more from the riders themselves? And what did you find? What was the pushback? And I say that because the critics are going to say, well, if TriMet's only in the middle, yet they're asking for, which my calculation, I think it's a 14 or 15% increase in the payroll tax. Why didn't we go down the fair side first?
Again, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, if you look at the actual fare we charge, it is on the higher end of middle in terms of what the actual user is paying. Our fare box recovery rate, however, which is kind of how much do fares pay as a total, that's where we're really about in the middle. We do look very, very closely at increasing fares. We have historically increased almost every year at a nickel. During the high price of diesel, we've actually ended up putting in an additional amount to be able to help cover that diesel extra cost on diesel. But I would say that from the standpoint of what the individual pays, they are at the upper end of the middle range. And if you look across the country, even New York City, that's proposing to be able to increase to $2.50. That has now been cut back, but even in New York City, at about our same rate on a per dollar basis.
Yes,
per ride.
So we're at the upper end of the middle with TriMet's at
yes.
the upper end of the middle.
Absolutely.
with the fares. How does that compare to what is the TriMet rider getting for that upper end of the middle compared to other transportation busing companies?
That you see that the system as a whole provides that seventh highest per capita ridership. Clearly, people are wanting to be able to use it. We have another way to look at it is how many of what we call choice riders, that is, they have a vehicle or access to a vehicle but choose to be able to ride us. 72% of our riders are those choice riders. So all in all, what I think we are seeing is that people people want the system, they are using the system, and they're using it extensively, not just for work trips. They are, in fact, some of our highest ridership in midday are appearing on the weekends on light rail. Our frequent service buses, which are buses that come at least every 15 minutes all day long into the evenings and on Saturdays and Sundays, there are real workhorses. Likewise, they carry people who want to use our system.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
one
please.
Last follow-up.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not trying to lead you to this, Fred, but I'm sort of hearing this a little bit. TriMet, given the wonderful city in which it operates, the great amenities that the city offers, TriMet's doing a lot more than some other transportation services for transporting people to enjoy the city and to get around the city, not necessarily for work purposes. I mean, what we're talking here is about taxing work, okay? But and when the benefit of the bus service or the transportation service is for that, is to bring people to and from their work, then there's a, and I know that's a lot of what TriMet, maybe the majority of what TriMet does, but there's a nexus there. But what I hear a little bit from you is you're saying that TriMet sort of above, maybe greatly above the average in transporting people as a quality of life, as a way to get out on the weekends and see the city. And that's why I would have, Mr. Chair, some reservations about looking to increase the work tax before we looked at maybe getting from the higher end of the middle to the lower end of the upper as far as the fares go.
Chairman, again, Representative Bruin, what I would like to be able to do is, and I will certainly do this for the record for you, is to be able to really outline where fares are in relationship to other major cities. And I think you will see us, whether or not I was generalizing by the upper of the middle, it depends on where you draw that line, or the lower of the higher fare. The single largest use for our system is still the work trip. That is the majority. But what we are seeing is that people use it for lots of other reasons. One of the reasons why businesses have supported this is because it brings customers to their door as well. And so a benefit of, even if it is for a shopping trip or other purpose trip, it is still a very real benefit to the businesses. So I think that's one of the reasons why you have seen the Portland Business Association, OBA, the Oregon Business Association as well, have, in fact, you will hear from some of those people, support this because they see it very critically important to their business, even though they are the ones that are paying that tax.
Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Fred, thank you very much. I actually have you kind of touched on my last point, with your last point, one of my questions, which was that the business community sees benefit beyond moving its workforce to and from the workplace. And I want to dig down a bit into this and really talk about the benefit that my community receives as a result of this payroll tax. And so one of them is definitely that you say the business community sees a benefit in moving its workforce, sees a benefit as well in the movement of customers to and from their places of business and helping commerce and business thrive. Could you talk to me a little bit about TriMet's workforce development and efforts in to diversify the construction workforce? TriMet has some of the committee members may not know that TriMet has a fantastic track record of bringing women and minorities, strategically disadvantaged or traditionally disadvantaged business entities, into the construction workforce. And TriMet is at the forefront of doing this, one of the best agencies in the state at this. And if you could speak to that a bit, because I think that's a benefit we're purchasing as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Call. We are very, very proud of what our construction efforts have been in terms of being able to employ minority and women-owned businesses, not only in terms of direct hire on the building of our projects, which has been exemplary, but we've also found very creative ways to be able to, in fact, break down larger contracts into smaller contracts, thereby allowing some of those disadvantaged businesses to be able to actually participate. We have gotten the high quality work, the highest of quality work, at a very competitive price, and yet what we've been able to do is to be able to engage people who have historically not been a part of public construction projects. We have done that, as I say, by being able to really be creative, and I think we have set the bar very, very high for our projects. Again, these are projects that are being funded, at least historically, by 60% federal funding. Funding that would have gone to Denver or to Atlanta or someplace else, but have been coming here to create jobs for Oregonians. We also find that by having projects broken down into smaller bite-sized pieces, that is for construction bidding purposes, we also find that large firms from around the country don't find them very attractive to bid on. It means that Oregonians are being put back to work, certainly what we are also doing, utilizing stimulus dollars. So we're very, very proud of that record. Thank you for pointing it out.
Mr. Chair, if I might, and just going into a bit more into some of the benefits that we see, I mean, I think we've touched on here very clearly the kind of benefits to business on a bunch of fronts here that I think are really important and make TriMet, you know, kind of at the forefront a lot of a model for cities of our size, especially throughout the country. But I'd also like to talk about, you know, senior and disabled transport, the benefit that we're providing to that community that is so underserved oftentimes, what the cost looks like to TriMet of that. If you could compare the costs of servicing that community with a traditional fixed route community of riders, and what that means in the terms of, you know, your overall budget.
Mr. Chairman, again, Representative Call, I'd be very happy to. All transit properties across the country, not just even us or Lane, has exactly the same sorts of issues. The transportation of what are referred to as the elderly and disabled through a Lyft service, that is the paratransit buses that are taking people who oftentimes have no choice but to be able to have that individualized trip. The federal law mandates that the Americans with Disabilities Act requires that the transit properties provide that service. We do more than just the minimum. Instead of just curb-to-curb, we actually provide door-to-door service, which is, in some cases, the only way people are able to get transportation. Let me stress, though, that it's very important. We transport about 10 million elderly disabled riders per year. 1 million of those are on the Lyft service, that is that paratransit. 9 million are on our buses and our light rail vehicles already. In terms of cost, average cost is just a little over $2 on our bus and MAX light rail system. It is right around $26 per ride in the paratransit, the little buses that are for elderly and disabled. So certainly, not only is it an essential service, and for some people, it's the only way they can get transported. For others, they can take some of their trips on the paratransit, others on the fixed, what we call fixed route, that is the buses, the MAX, at a much more cost-effective way.
Thank you,
Chair Barnhart.
Yes, please.
Representative Call, could I also respond
please,
to that?
Please do, yes.
At LTD, the state funding for elderly and transit has remained the same, which I assume is the case at TriMet as well. As our demand has just increased tremendously, it's increasing at the rate of around 10% a year. So this year, we're going to have to take obviously, our budget's a lot different than theirs, but we're going to have to take about $2.5 million out of our operating budget to cover our elderly and disabled transit. Our state funding has remained level at about $600,000 a year. So you can see that that's eating into our operating costs tremendously and part of the cause of our budget problems currently.
And where does that funding come from?
That's just our regular operating.
No, I'm sorry, the $600,000.
That is state. That's from the cigarette tax.
That's the cigarette tax.
Yes.
2 cents on the cigarette tax.
Right. And the same is true for TriMet.
Yes. That, by the way, that 2 cents is applied across the state. So it's not just transit properties. It could be also small areas, okay. Klamath Falls, others as well.
Other places. Representative Call?
Yes.
Go ahead.
And then
you know, moving a little deeper into the elderly and disabled transport, since we've touched on the cigarette tax, there have been projections that we're going to see a significantly diminished amount of revenue that's coming into elderly and disabled transport as a result of the SCHIP reauthorization at the federal level. Can you talk to me about, can you explain to us what that shortfall is going to look like for your transit districts and the way in which the capacity here to utilize, to increase the payroll tax once economic recovery has happened to help, you know, mitigate the damage of that shortfall?
I'll go first, let Lane address it as well. The vast majority of our elderly and disabled transportation services are currently paid for out of our general revenue. The cigarette tax revenue does account for a little less than $1 million that comes to TriMet. That represents about 3% of our total cost on elderly and disabled. So the vast majority is, in fact, out of our general fund. Consequently, any kind of assistance is something that that we need. Now, we work very, very closely with advocate groups for the elderly to be able to help them do training, buddy riders, other things to be able to help people find those times where they can, if they can, to be able to use the fixed guideway system, because it's both cheaper and gives them more control over their lives. And it's really a better quality control for them over their own lives. But for those people who have no choice, it is a very expensive service and one that we are just essentially now eating out of our general fund.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Call, I can tell you that, as I mentioned in my testimony, the board actually implemented a 14.5% service reduction for LTD to be implemented this fall. We were able to dodge that bullet by using stimulus funds, but that's a one-time only dodge. Any reduction in our revenue is going to have a serious impact on the level of service we can provide. This taking place at a time when fuel prices are unpredictable and the need for employees to be able to get to work inexpensively is as great as it's ever been.
Thank you. Lieutenant Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in more of a historical perspective in one sense with the challenges I suspect you're confronting already in terms of your budget and the prospect of some additional revenue coming in. I imagine you've already been making a lot of efforts on improving your own operations in terms of efficiency, and I can think of a variety of measures, whether it's the cost per ride, whether it's the costs even of your own internal operations, and I'd like to hear what you've been doing in that on that front and how we might expect that would be integrated into your ongoing efforts so that we don't have to hear in another decade it's time for another increase.
I'll respond first, if I may, Chair Barnhart and Representative Reed. First off is, in November 22nd of 1999, I launched internally to TriMet an effort we call the PIP, the Productivity Improvement Program. And really what we did is engaged our frontline workers who did the work, did the real work. How could they make it better? How could they make it more efficient and in the process save money? That program has been ongoing, and we have saved over $20 million, not just one-time only savings, but on an annualized basis over and over again. And it reflects everything from how do we do our put our buses through the wash and fuel line, making it more efficient, to vinyl seats on our light rail vehicles, which are, in fact, a much easier to clean. Very, very important, and a whole host of other improvements. Likewise, when we look at the growth in our ridership and look at on a per-cost basis, take the decade 1998 through 2008, the last year for which data are available for complete years, we have seen that our cost per ride has actually increased only 8% during that decade, much less than what the cost is if we're just adjusted by inflation. What that means is that we have been getting more and more people filling empty seats, been able to run more efficiently, and been able to, in fact, hold down costs throughout our organization. And I think those are very, very two examples of things that we're very proud of that is a part of that ongoing efficiency effort.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Reed, I can't quote as eloquently statistics, but I can tell you that also in response to the question raised by Representative Bruhn, that we have increased our fares 20% just this year. So we've gone to the fare box. We have to keep in mind that some of our riders are people that are totally dependent on transit. I was at a public hearing where a woman testified to me that she took the bus to the hospital when she was having a heart attack. She had no way to pay for an ambulance. She had no one else to give her a ride. We have riders that are totally dependent on transit to get their groceries, to get to their doctor appointments, to get their pharmaceuticals, in this case, to get to the hospital. So we have a range of riders. We have people from one end that could afford to take their Mercedes-Benz to work and have decided to save and not add to the congestion on the road, not add to fuel consumption, not add to greenhouse gases, and take the bus. On the other hand, we have the lady who took the bus to the hospital when she was having a heart attack. We also pay very close attention to efficiency. I've got a chart that I wish I had with me that demonstrates the number of service hours that we provide over time, and that line goes like this. And there's another line on the chart that indicates ridership over time, and that line goes like this. So you can see that dollars spent in public transit and LTD are very effectively spent.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was answered.
It was. Good. Representative Vance. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're being asked to approve a $50 million increase on a budget of $450 million. Is that right? Is that what we're doing?
The numbers that we have for TriMet, Chair Barnhart and Representative Beth, is about $32 million if it was fully implemented. That is not adjusted for inflation, but today it would be for TriMet about $32 million if it were the full tenth of a percent were implemented. But as you know, the bill establishes it to be able to be phased in at on average 0.01% over a 10-year period.
Yes, please.
If I could go back to, I think, Representative Bruhn's question, I wasn't quite sure of the answer. You're in the high middle of where exactly?
If one looks across the nation at what it costs to be able to ride transit, we're at well above halfway in terms of the cost. That is, our riders are paying more than the majority of other properties around the nation. I don't have the exact numbers, and I'll be happy to supply that for the record.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Please, yes.
I was looking at the last page of your handout.
Yes.
And I noticed that it appears that the passenger revenue is about 20.5% of what it takes to run the operation. And after this, $32 million is added in, that's going to drop by some number. What will the passenger be actually paying if this is fully implemented?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Betts, the difficulty is that over time we have historically raised our fares on about an annualized basis, maybe 1 year out of five that we don't. And so I would expect that which has been about at the rate of inflation. Consequently, it would surprise me if those numbers changed very much. And it depends, obviously, on not only the increase in the payroll tax, but also in the sense of employment. Right now, employment's down, certainly in the metropolitan area, and that means our overall revenues are down without regard to whether or not there is an increase. So it's going to be, there are going to be a number of factors. Certainly one of them is just total jobs that are, in fact, there. Two is general inflation rate, but we would expect that ratio, and our goal of our board has always been to be able to have a fare box recovery rate, in fact, a bit higher than where we are right now. Those numbers are a little bit low. We have seen over the last about 8 months that it's moved up to about 22% recovery rather than the 20.5 that is there on that chart.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So assuming that it's somewhere between 20 and 22% recovery rate, that is about one-fifth of the true cost of what it's taking to move a passenger in Portland. Can you now put that in perspective nationwide? Is that normal for the folks to be paying about one-fifth or less than what the true cost is for this type of transport?
We are right about in the middle of the national average, so the answer is yes, that's just right about where it is nationwide.
Yes, please.
Slightly different angle. I want to go back to Representative Berger's question about who it is that oversees the operations of TriMet. If we had a question or concern about any aspect of it, to whom should we address our questions? Would it be the board or would it be you?
It depends on the type of question, Mr. Chairman. Representative Benz, certainly the board is available. Our president of our board is George Pasador. You may know that name, retired chief executive, Wells Fargo. There are six other board members. They certainly would be, and I'm certainly available for any questions as well.
Thank you. Representative Broome?
No, thank you. Fred, sorry I'm picking on you. I just know TriMet better.
That's okay. You're just across
the line. Exactly. I'm not picking on you.
And
I
would ask Mr. Eister to chime in anytime he wants to add to an answer.
If this didn't get passed, if this didn't happen, what would you be forced to do? What would TriMet be forced to do? And I assume it's coming at the fare box, but I don't know that for sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broome, the issue for us is that we have dedicated the 2003 authorized increase, as well as what we would expect to do here, to new service. That could be new service of Lyft. It could be for buses. But most importantly, it has been our ability to be able to show the federal government that as we plan to be able to expand our system, that we have that 20 years worth of operating revenue to be able to justify and be in line for federal dollars to build build and expand. Without this, we would, after the current project, not be able to look toward expansions of the system.
Okay, so to paraphrase what you're saying, Fred, you're saying this is primarily, this is not designed to take care of increasing costs, inflationary costs of the current system. This is designed primarily to expand the current system.
Am
I paraphrasing that correctly?
Okay. The answer is absolutely. And maybe one other thing that's important, you know, we've talked about from the business standpoint. We take out in the Portland region, although it currently meets federal air quality standards, it has been many years where it has not met, and we're close to that level. Because of our system, it's the equivalent of 9 Intel plants in the sense of what's available within the airshed. That obviously is an issue that's very important from an economic development standpoint as well, and it's because of public transit that people are out there in those individual cars causing us to violate air standards.
One more question.
Please.
And again, Fred, you'll forgive me. The way this is structured, the way this is, you know, some people look at this, oh, well, you're not, you know, you legislature, this revenue committee, floors of both chambers, you're not raising taxes, you're authorizing it. And the way I look at it, that's not quite accurate because there's really no representation. It's an appointed board. It's a great board, TriMet and Lane, I'm sure. But it's not a representative board. They're not elected. And so we are that representation for this taxation, Mr. Chair. The question that I have is I'm a little concerned about the economic sideboards, and I heard what you say. There's three economists, and they sort of agree or not on what the economic, the broader macroeconomic situation is. Can you help me? Can you drill down on that a little bit? We've looked at some other things about their specific targets, their specific employment targets, their specific, city domestic product growth targets. I'm a little concerned that there's not targets, but maybe there is within the commission to help say, okay, it's the time to trigger this tax or it's not the time to trigger this tax.
First, let me turn, if I may, Chair Barnhart and Representative Broome, to the bill itself. On the second page, lines really beginning at line 9, it makes it explicit what must be found, a finding that would apply to the TriMet board as well as the LTD committee board, and that is that the board must make a finding that the economy in the district has recovered to an extent sufficient to warrant the increase in tax. In making the finding, the board shall consider regional employment and income growth. What we did in 2003, and we would expect to be able to do the exact same thing, and my guess is this is not earlier than 2012. It's as much as I'd like to see. I think we'd all like to see the economy recover much quicker than that. I think we're just going to have to wait and see. But whatever the case is, we asked explicitly those three economists representing a range of different philosophical approaches that they have taken to be able to explicitly tell us, are these facts being addressed? What is, in fact, the state of income and employment within the TriMet region, and does it justify that that increase? Let me also stress that any action taken by the TriMet board can certainly be referred to the ballot by the signature gathering process as well. So there are checks that are there. It is not a it is not just the TriMet board.
One last follow-up. Would it be possible and consider that, say, it did go out to 2012 or 2013 before this panel of three economists decided it was okay to do this? You have a 10-year window. Okay, that 10-year window doesn't roll out. It compresses as it doesn't. It does roll out. I guess you're talking about a 1 percentage point increase in the payroll tax, which is whatever it is, 13 or 14% increase.
1/10 of a percent.
Right.
Increase.
Right. Okay. Still 13 or 14% increase based on the current level. But you have a 10-year window to do that. Is it? I guess my question is that 1/10 of 1% increase, though, does it come and you do it yearly? I mean, you have a period to do that yearly, though. Is that the? I have to phrase this correctly.
And while you're doing that, you might reference lines 16 and 17 on the second page of the bill.
Right.
Because they set the limits on what the
rate. So when you begin, Fred, that's when the 10-year period starts.
Yes.
Not 10 years from when this bill is enacted. Okay, that's right. That's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. That's helpful. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bence's questions prompted it. Perhaps a comment or a request in my mind as you're putting together data, I think it would also be interesting to see the level of the fare that is paid by the TriMet customer compared to the salary level within the area served by the transit district. I would imagine that, for example, in New York, a comparable fare is not, in fact, a comparable fare, given that salaries are much higher in the New York area. And, Mr.
Please, Mayor, yes.
Is it correct to say, then, that a major consequence of this bill, if it does not pass, is that it will put into jeopardy federal dollars that can be used for investment in the short term, not just the long term, in the metro area?
Chairman, Representative Bailey, it depends a little bit on what you mean by the short term, but the answer is these dollars are able to be used to be able to match federal dollars and are very, very important to be able to get those federal dollars, in fact, critical to get them. And so to be able to have essentially leveraging what we historically have been able to do, that is 60 cents on every local dollar we've been able to put forward, is a pretty good return on investment because of this payroll tax.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Please, yeah.
So it appears that what we have is a situation where we are asking our business community to ante in to something where they will see increased economic growth in the region. We have our business association saying yes to this bill, and that will create jobs here in Oregon and help get our economy back on track. Is that the case?
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up question to Representative Reed's question, and that is what all the rest of our state is suffering dramatically from our economic difficulties. And I guess I need to know what TriMet has done in light of that. Has it what has it done to try to show the rest of the population that it too recognizes these difficulties and it's taking them into account
and that you can, I needed a little more detail than that which was provided by Representative Reed.
Several things, obviously, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Barnhart, and Representative Vance. When the economy began to deteriorate, we began taking steps immediately. We have reduced across-the-board reductions. I've ordered now a total of 8% reductions. We have been able to hold the amount of the effect on the on service by also utilizing some of the stimulus dollars that are one-time only. That is a $23.6 million reduction we have put into place across the board. Number two, other than those individuals that are controlled by a labor contract, I have ordered a salary freeze and, in fact, have voluntarily taken a two-week furlough, as I have also of my senior executive. We have no increased salary for our management people. Again, our union is, in fact, controlled by contract, and that would require negotiation within that contract.
Please. I'm sorry, I didn't catch what the 8% reduction was in.
Across, what I did is I ordered 8% across every section of TriMet. On the actual direct delivery of service, I've been able to hold those reductions to about half that is about 4%, by being able to utilize stimulus dollars to offset some of those service cuts. But the reduction in all other places, what some people might think of as overhead, it's everything from our legal department to our accounting department, that has all been reduced by 8% in the 2010 budget. We have also reduced in the existing 2009 budget as well.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Call.
Yeah, thank you. And since we're talking about some of the reductions that were thought to be necessary, and some of which were forestalled by the stimulus package, the federal stimulus package, could you just, Fred, could you just talk a little bit about what some of those proposed cuts were? You know, I know that there were some cuts proposed into Clackamas County, reaching into some communities that are within the urban growth boundary, but very at the outskirts of that boundary, and you know what life is like there, what the economic conditions are there, and how important it is for those communities that are further out to have access to transit, and some of the proposed cuts you guys were entertaining in that regard.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Call, one of the most difficult things that any of us, and I know I'd be joined by LTD on this, in transit is to cut service. That's the last thing you want to do because that's what we're all about. And yet in this economic crisis, we had to. In the Clackamas County area, we looked very hard at a number of lines. In fact, just proposed to discontinue a series of lines in that area. As we went through the public comment and the public hearing process, we were able to craft a solution. I'll take one example, the line 157, which serves the Happy Valley area. The community came forward to us and said, we really want to be able to keep that line, at least on a pilot basis, because when the light rail, Green Line, opens, we want to be able to, we think we can attract more people to be able to move them on the 157 to Clackamas Town Center and thereby able to ride. We said we will take a six-month extension of that line, but we're going to have to judge, does it really produce the kind of ridership? And so we're working both with the community, the neighborhoods, but also with Clackamas County about how do we really encourage people to be able to make use of that. But that's one example of a line where we had scheduled it to be able to be eliminated and chose to be able to pull back from that, but we've had to make other cuts in a number of other places that generally from our standpoint we looked at whether or not people were using it, that line, for transit dependent reasons, job or education. Did they have any other choices? Two, were there routes that could be nearby, maybe not quite as convenient, but that they had some other kind of service? And if they did, and we could make other service work, we've had to actually cut that. It's been painful, and it's affected ability for people to get around quite as conveniently as they have in the past, but that was necessary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, I can tell you that last fall when we were holding public hearings regarding our reduction in services. I fully expected to hear from students or retired people. The people who were showing up to the public hearings were people who couldn't get to work if we cut the service. They were desperate for a way to get to work. And that's what we're going to have to do if we don't have the funding.
Other questions? Thank you. I have a couple, and some of them have been prompted by the discussion, and some of them are perhaps a little bit beyond it. I want to look at the larger picture, and some of the comments that you've made about the use of the new money is, I think, important in this. I think one of the long-term goals, and please help me if I've got this wrong. I think one of the long-term goals is to make it easy for people to move around to get their work done, their business done, with using private automobiles less often in both areas.
That's right.
I'm getting head nods, so okay. I also assume that as ridership increases, as it has in both systems that you represent, there are two things that occur. One of them is that you fill more seats on existing buses and other transit systems that you already have, and therefore the system becomes more efficient in that sense. The other thing is that I'm sure there are times when you find yourself having to put on extra service in order to service the need. On a busy morning or evening when people are commuting, you may find yourself adding a bus or reducing the intervals between buses in order to make that all happen. Again, I'm getting head nods.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, part of the change in your financing comes about simply because of changes in the economic activity. As economic activity goes up, one assumes the amount of dollars that the payroll tax at the rate that it is, whatever that is, also goes up.
That's right.
And therefore, you're able to service some of this increase. I also assume that to some extent there is a situation in which you can't make up in volume when you don't make a profit in the first place. If you're only getting 22% of your cost paid by the fare box, you're going to get some improvement by increasing the number of bodies in the seats. But when you have to add service in order to service the same area, your costs go up beyond what the fares will produce. Again, I apparently I'm right about that.
Absolutely.
As well. All of this long kind of monologue is to get to the question, and that is, where do we go in the long term? Do either of you have a sense of where the limits are on the payroll tax? And where we need to go in the long term to fund these systems. And let me just give you an image out there. The image that I have is that in the long run, whether this is really going to happen or not, no one knows. But in the long run, many more people will routinely use the public transit systems and either park their cars or maybe not even have one. And when as that happens, the need to actually support this system somewhere out in the world other than at the fare box is going to increase and not decline. Where do we get that money? Is this approach viable in the long haul? Can we continue raising the payroll tax forever? Or should we be thinking about something else? And if so, for the long term, what is that something else? I recognize this is not an easy question. What are your thoughts?
Let me give some perspective from the TriMet standpoint, and you'll hear, I'm sure, from LTD. First off is that the greater Portland region is expected over the next 20 years to be able to see a population increase of about 1 million more people, 650,000 more jobs, 450,000 more households. So those additional jobs, and again, I think that the optimistic nature of how fast that will begin to get produced is maybe slowed, but still additional jobs in the greater Portland metropolitan region. And although not all of those jobs would be covered by the payroll tax, that is, those that are in Clark County, Washington, would not be subject to it, the majority of those jobs will be. And so you'll see a natural growth within the payroll tax. If you do maybe another comparison and look at where those regions that utilize sales tax, you will see that most other places charge between half a cent and some places all the way up to 1 cent on sales tax to be able to be dedicated to transit. And if you look at the overall sales tax burden, that represents a substantially larger portion of those operating expenses that are coming from that tax source than typically we're seeing from the payroll tax within this within our region. But I do believe that it is a part of whether or not we're ever going to see tax restructuring across the state of Oregon or not. And I think you all are much better to speculate on that than I would be.
Chair Barnhart, our current MX line that runs 4 miles between Springfield and Eugene is carrying 6,000 passengers a day on work days. That's a tremendous increase over what the previous regular bus had been providing. In fact, in our first year of operation, we exceeded our 20-year projection. The next year, we exceeded that by 20%, and this year, we're exceeding that. So it's very efficient. Transit dollars spent are being used extremely efficiently. It's clear that we do need some other revenue source, and I'm not sure quite what it is, but it is clear that we that another revenue source would balance out the volatility that we experience when the economy goes up and down.
Thank you. That's for any other questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Well, let's hear from Duke Shepherd and Marion Haynes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Duke Shepherd with the AFL-CIO. I will just say that we have workers who build transit systems, who operate, maintain, and drive the vehicles, and workers who ride to get to work. So we think this is an important bill to pass to allow both transit systems to do what they do long-term, especially in light of getting the federal matches that create even more job opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, committee members, Marion Haynes with the Oregon Business Association. OBA supports Senate Bill 34, giving transit districts the authority to increase the payroll tax for transit operations. There's really four reasons that we're supportive of this. One is that transit service does help free up road capacity for freight and goods movement that is non-discretionary and has no option but to move on the roads, largely in trucks. That is going to continue to grow the importance of freight traffic in the future, and so clearing up the roadways for those kinds of uses are important for the economy. Also for employee commuting, as we've heard, that's been, in our experience, a very important aspect of the transit system. and definitely can't overlook bringing in or having the money for the operations in order to show that you've got that to bring in the federal money. We've been very successful in bringing in federal match here and would like to see that continue. It is money that could go to other areas. And then finally, the role of transit in helping the state reach our greenhouse gas reduction goals. That is also part of trying to accomplish those goals. And for those four reasons, we support Senate Bill 34. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? That was very clear. Thank you very much. Mr. Charles, back in his usual role.
He's happy.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, John Charles, back in my usual role. Cascade Policy Institute, I'm here to call your attention to a few issues that haven't yet come up. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to testify on the Senate side due to the very shortness of the notification of hearings and the randomness of my travel schedule, so the issues that I'm raising in the testimony that I've passed out to your assistant today, I think, offer you a chance to dig deep into this issue in a way that hasn't yet occurred in this process. By way of background, I've been a long-time transit user. I've ridden TriMet at least 20,000 times, all of their modes. And as a researcher, even though as a heading cascade, I don't get to do much original research anymore. The area that I am working on and have been for about a decade is in transit-oriented development. And so I am pretty familiar with TriMet, and I'm going to direct my comments to TriMet and not Lane Transit District, only because I don't know as much about LTD. But I encourage you to ask these kinds of questions. I'd like to go back to the 2003 payroll tax increase and the stated rationale. And what I've closed my written testimony is an excerpt from a letter from Mr. Hansen to the Central Eastside Industrial Council in 2004 stating why they wanted the 2003 payroll tax increase. And as he just said here, it's the exact same rationale. In order to qualify for federal funding, we have to have this money, and specifically that this will be to provide new service in the regional system. Okay, it was authorized in 2003, went into effect in January 2005. My question is, where is the new service? Page 2 of my testimony, I have a summary here of various metrics that one would use to look at new service, total vehicles, peak hour vehicles, revenue hours, vehicle miles of those vehicles. And over that period of time, even though operating revenue went up 50% and total revenue went up 60%, actual service hardly went up or actually declined by some metrics. So that raises the question of, well, you have a 10-year payroll tax increase, 2005 to 2015. In 2006, in particular, service dropped. Right now, service is dropping and projected to drop for 2010. Where'd all the money go? Okay, well, I would say if the legislature in 2003 had looked at the history of TriMet, they would have seen, actually, since day one, there's been very little correlation between money spent and ridership. If there's ever a case where throwing more money at an institution is not called for, it's this case. There's very little correlation. Money has gone up. Total revenue since the beginning of 5,800% and ridership 448% for TriMet. Now, in the last 4 years, the agency could reasonably assert, and they might, that actual service hasn't increased very much because so much money has gone into expensive new projects that are not actually operating yet. The mall project, the Green Line out on 205, the commuter rail project, which only opened a few months ago. And that, in fact, points out the fatal flaw of the TriMet Metro City of Portland strategy for the last 20 years, which is this obsession with rail transit is killing. It's a fiscally suicidal mission. And, in fact, the newest high-profile line that now is operating the West is a classic example of what's wrong with this strategy. It required a lot of money, certainly compared to buses, and yet that right-of-way is hardly used at all. 8 times in the morning, 8 times in the afternoon, none the rest of the day. Compared to what it competes with, I-217, I-5, those facilities are used 24/7 by many modes of travel. The rail vehicles are expensive. The project was so wasteful it wasn't going to get money from the feds because it broke one of their cost-effectiveness guidelines. It only got built because Senator Gordon Smith bailed it out with an earmark that was exempt from that requirement. TriMet's estimate of ridership was way over the mark. They estimated 2,400 to 3,000 riders on opening day. Well, the last 2 months, it's only had about 1,140 boardings, which is half of that is actual riders. Not only that, public pronouncements, TriMet predicted that half of West riders would be new to transit. But one of their own financial documents from December 2003 said flat out, commuter rail service is expected to displace 246,000 annual TriMet bus boardings when customers switch from bus to the new West service. If that estimate proves true, about 80% of the West ridership is going to be previous bus riders. There's hardly any new growth, but we spent $160 million. Not only that, the operational costs of the West are going to be staggering. I've laid it out here from the TriMet documents. I mean, $21 per originating ride, $875 per hour, $336,000 per month operating deficit stretched to infinity. Now, I've been on the West probably 20 days, 40 different trips. It's fun. It's got big, comfortable seats, onboard free Wi-Fi. No one ever asked me for a fare. The customers, the people who work there never ask anybody for a fare. But it's not financially sustainable. I'll just go through quickly some of these other points, and then you can ask questions. So there's a capital problem here. All the capital revenue is going to these mega expensive projects, rail, transit. Operationally, going back decades, TriMet's labor and employee benefit structure is fiscally unsustainable. Cost of their benefits, if you look here on page 4, just since 2001, the percent of benefits as a percent of wages has gone from 61% to 118%. How does this compare with the industry? I looked at New Jersey Transit, third biggest transit district in the country, heavily unionized labor. Okay, well, their fringe benefit as a percent of wages has gone from 61% to 64 to 71 to 72% in the last 6 years. That's still far below TriMet. And if you go on the APTA database, the average of all agencies nationwide is 66%. Why is TriMet so high up there? On page 5, within fringe benefits, the pension costs have been just cannibalizing the budget for decades. TriMet did move new employees to a defined contribution plan in 03. I supported that. Of course, it's easy to do that. You're doing something for employees not yet there to defend themselves from the change. But as far as both the bargaining unit and the management plan, I provided data going over decades. This is not just a one-time problem. This has been building. This has been a time bomb building for years. And who's been mining the store? Okay, well, the last time someone tried, the TriMet chair in 1994, Lauren Weiss, he had a very public disagreement with then-general manager Tom Walsh over the labor agreement. He predicted all these things were going to happen, and for his public service, he was asked to come down to the Capitol by Governor Roberts, and an hour later, he was no longer on the TriMet board. Since then, I've been to dozens and dozens of TriMet board meetings. I've seen very little oversight asking any hard questions about this. Now, most interesting, I went to the TriMet board meeting about 6 weeks ago where their budget advisory committee presented this report, and I've attached 3 pages of it for you. And the budget committee is picked by TriMet, and they look at different issues each year. This year they looked at employee benefits, and they made a very impressive presentation to the TriMet board. Among other things, they pointed out that TriMet is paying $1,932 monthly family health care premium. It's the highest reported in the U.S. Transit System survey for current and retirees. The response of one of the TriMet board members, whose day job is to be, he's a Teamsters negotiator, he just said, you know, for my Teamsters, if we get employers to pay $1,000 a month for health care, we call that Cadillac care. Well, what do you call $1,900 a month? We're paying that. This is what's cannibalizing the general fund. This is why the payroll tax increase you just authorized 6 years ago isn't enough, apparently. I've got some data here about market share. Despite all this money, TriMet's losing market share in their most natural market, which is downtown. Our BMT per capita in Portland is actually inferior to the Portland-Vancouver region. And one of the final points I'll make is this whole issue that we have to have this now to leverage federal dollars. Okay, I heard that in 2003. The Green Line isn't even built out there on I-205. And as we speak, TriMet is proposing to cut the service. The Yellow Line was built with federal money. They're proposing to cut the service. What happened to the 20-year promise? Apparently, it's a little more flexible than I was suggested, and that maybe this money isn't quite as important, or that other sources of money, such as raising passenger fares, could be used. So, as you know, I like to propose alternatives when I criticize things, and my alternatives suggest to you to examine would be, first of all, get rid of Fareless Square. I've been an opponent of it ever since I moved to Portland 29 years ago. The original rationale was to comply with CO standards under the Federal Clean Air Act. Going back decades, that rationale has long since become moot. There's 86,000 weekday riders down there. Many of them have paid before they enter, but TriMet, in a report released just about 4 months ago, estimates between $2.7 and $3.26 million a year lost in revenue, direct revenue, plus loss of productivity of all those vehicles having to slow down, taking a longer time to get through downtown because of all the excess on-offs and people who jump on and get off two blocks later. Well, when labor is your biggest cost, you're fighting for every bit of productivity. This is a loss in productivity. Three out of the four members of this Budget Advisory Committee said last month they firmly support eliminating Perilous Square, but I haven't seen any proposal from the board to do that yet. The next is the union contract is up this year. I think before any talk of raising the payroll tax rate is approved, they have got to commit to making some changes in that contract. I mean, it is not sustainable. You can't just print money. The third thing is, I think you really need to try and get TriMet to reconsider their high-cost rail strategy when the big success story for TriMet has been on the bus side. And my final data set here on page 8 is from their own Transportation Improvement Program report, FY09. I mean, look, this frequent service strategy of going from 4 lines of frequent service to 16 over a 9-year period, and the number of boardings going up from 210,000 per week to 705,000. That is impressive. Everything about this data set on page 8 is impressive. That's on the rubber tired side, which gets virtually no respect in transit circles in Portland. It's all about steel wheels. I think there's the real gains are to be on the bus side, and that's been the orphan child of the system. I think also it's a final point to what you said, Mr. Chairman, about, you know, when you're losing money per transaction, you can't make it up in volume. A lot of agencies have been very successful with contracting out either certain lines or the entire system. I have worked with the City of Sandy to secede successfully from TriMet in 1999, and in 2000, Sandy opened up their own system. And it's been hugely successful, way more service, 6 days a week instead of 5 days a week, all day instead of peak hour. And they've contracted out the whole thing. They have no unfunded pension liability, and they have 2.2 FTEs in the city budget. Gee.
Thank you very much.
So I just think that I hope you don't work this bill today. I hope that you maybe ask the chair of the TriMet board to come down and ask some hard questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Charles? Representative
Bailey. Not a question so much as a comment. I have appreciated in this discussion the concern that's been shown from around the state for how businesses, especially in the TriMet area, are able to deal with the level of service and the relationship between that and the financial mechanisms. The reality is that we have an area where we have businesses that want this, and we have constituents that want this. This is pretty cut and dry. And in answer to the question of what do we get, where has been the service improvement, Mr. Charles referenced the Central Eastside Industrial Area that happens to be in my district. And the fact is that we recently celebrated the announcement of a major investment of federal dollars into the Central East Side area for a streetcar line that is going to bring service and jobs directly to a community that's struggling and to help revitalize an area that has lagged behind in economic development because of a lack of connectivity and because of a lack of a quality of life that fixed rail can bring. Now, I understand that there are often emotional and ideological prejudices against fixed rail, but the reality is that it has had remarkable results in the metro area. It is going to be a major investment in the inner east side. It is something that the businesses there want, the people want. This is an important bill, and I hope we move it today.
Thank you. To what extent does your analysis apply to Lane Transit District?
That's true.
Mr. Chairman, I spent some time looking through audited financial statements that were available on the web, which were only for a limited number of years. My two general conclusions were I'm highly suspicious of the move to BRT. I think it's a lot of money for benefits, although I need to learn more about that. and at least a three-year trend I saw on benefits, fringe benefits as a percent of wages, is that it's not as bad as with TriMet, but the trend is moving in the wrong direction towards much higher costs. And I just think those would be things I believe that would be worthy of your asking some additional questions of.
Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 34, open a work session on Senate Bill 34. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 34 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 34 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have appreciated the discussion today and some of the things that TriMet has done and is doing. The fact of the matter, however, is that this is a payroll tax increase, and the folks in these areas, here we are in this, as Representative Boone pointed out, we are sort of the deciders in this, and yet under the board system where they are appointed boards, aren't even elected, there's very little recourse if the folks, say, in Lane or TriMet, objected to this. There's almost no recourse for them, and there's some significant questions raised here about the cost effectiveness of some of these rail lines and everything else. But the real problem to me is this is a payroll tax, and the wrong time to be raising this tax at this time. I appreciate that they tried to put sideboards around this and move slowly and add language about improvement in the economy, but if that's the case, we could wait two more years and do this. I am not comfortable. We also heard testimony that there's going to be a reduction in income because of payroll being cut. So this is not the time in my mind to raise payroll tax. I cannot support this despite the fact that there's some compelling testimony from TriMet about what their needs are. We are faced all the time down here with needs that we cannot fulfill in a bad economy, and this is one that I just cannot support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other comments? Representative Call.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say that I've had a chance to look at this bill once before now in our Transportation Committee, and I really appreciate what the transit folks have been able to do when coming in and testifying. They've brought an ample amount of evidence forward for the need for this, and they've worked hard to make sure that they've built a large coalition of support outside of this place, especially in my community. And so I just wanted to, before we went to a vote, I really wanted to express my gratitude and appreciation for their capacity to come in and make a really compelling argument.
Thank you. Representative Brune.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I've said before, we'll continue to say, TriMet is an outstanding organization. I think the management there, I think they do excellent work. I'm concerned, though, however, for a lot of the same reasons articulated by Representative Berger. In the last analysis, this is a tax on work. Too much work is not what we're suffering from in this state. It's quite the opposite of that, Mr. Chair. And so if we could have better sideboards on that, sideboards that we controlled legislatively through statute that said that certain triggers have to be met. I realize that there are, with the economists, there are folks there that are looking at this, but it is out of our control what those sideboards are at that point, Mr. Chair. And if the increase were something smaller and had come maybe later, I mean, we went, you know, whatever it was, 36 years from the original implementation until the one we increased in 2003, and now we're 6 years to this one. If you're looking at just the simple math, then we'll be 1 year to the next one, and that concerns me, Mr. Chair, so I too will be a no vote.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be a no vote on this, and I wanted to compliment Mr. Charles on his work. One of the greatest dangers that I think we run is the possibility that the argument can be made that we are engaging in self-dealing, and that's what Mr. Charles' report tends to reflect. And this makes it extraordinarily difficult to go to anyone and say that we are correctly raising a tax. And this
this TriMet does great work. I ride TriMet from the airport in, and I enjoy every moment of it. It's great. But the challenge when one looks at numbers like this is to say, how is the public entity bearing up under the challenge of our economic situation? And this report of Mr. Charles does not reflect that that's happening. And the danger is, when we go to our greater population and ask for support, they'll say no, because of situations similar to this. I appreciate the valuable work that transit provides, particularly as those who are incapable of making it around. I deeply appreciate it. But I think that as we face this economic situation, which is so grim, we have to be much more aware of what we're getting for what we're paying. And I agree with Mr. Charles's remarks regarding buses as opposed to the train. It's a big deal. It's a lot of money. I'll be voting no. I hope that the TriMet board will be more aggressive in trying to cut back its costs.
I am very cognizant of the local discussions in the Eugene-Springfield area of these kinds of changes, and I think it's extremely important that we heard from Mr. Eister today that the Eugene and Springfield Chambers of Commerce are neutral on the bill. I'm sure that was not an easy place for them to get to, knowing the way they think and the way they operate, as I do. I know them very well. They don't want to do anything that increased their costs. But it's obvious that, at least internally, there's at least a split and at least an understanding that in order to continue the development of our economy, the ability of people to move around, the things that the Oregon Business Association witness testified to about congestion and a variety of other issues, at least those very conservative organizations got to even. And that doesn't happen easily. I think this bill is ready, and I think it needs to go to the floor. Would you please call the roll, Carol? Thank you.
Aye.
Representative Dennis?
No.
Representative Berger?
No.
Representative Bruin?
No.
Representative Gelford?
Aye.
Representative Powell?
Aye.
Representative Reeves?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
No.
Chair Barker?
Chair votes aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is adopted, and the bill, Senate Bill 34, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Call, will
yes.
you carry the bill?
I would, sir.
Thank you. Representative Call will carry. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 34. I don't have any announcements to make, do I? I think we are not. We're going to reschedule 2180 and 3472.
Later,
at a later time. All right. With that, the committee's adjourned. Thank you. And we finished 35 minutes early.